Meeting of Parliament, Friday the 25th of September 2020, order proceedings. Communications from the Church.
The House has received a dispensation from the Director of Public Health that the wearing of face masks in Parliament is optional given that social distancing measures are in force. However, members have agreed that they will wear masks unless they are speaking or about to speak. Thank
you. So, thank you, Standing Order and Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I object to move under Standing Order 7.3 to suspend Standing Order 7.1 in order to proceed with a government statement.
Those in favour, those against, carry.
Mr. Speaker, the government roundly and unhesitatingly condemns the racist and anti-Semitic comments which have been made by some on social media in respect of today's vote for MP Marlene Hussain Mahmoud. Based on what the government very clear are untruth about Mr. Hussain holding a dual nationality with Israel, some people on social media have suggested that Mr. Hussain should somehow not be trusted with the involvement in the affairs of Gibraltar. And in our view, Mr. Speaker, those allegations clearly seek to bring people's estimation of Mr. Hussain down. Not by reason of arguments relating to her views and respect of any particular issue, but by reason of her religion. And Mr. Speaker, therefore, as the Senator and Leader of this House, I have referred those comments to the Royal Support of Police for investigation at racism and anti-Semitism, and I'm making this statement today for that reason. Mr. Speaker, we're very clear that challenging and robust political debate about ideas and policies is what makes our nation a rich, diverse, and respectful democracy. But for that reason also, we must decry and denounce those of a small minority who fail themselves and all of us also by making racist and anti-Semitic statements about a member of our parliament based solely on her religion. This is in addition, Mr. Speaker, to insult apparently also relating to her ethnicity, which she has rightly countered in correspondence and which I am also reviewing. Mr. Speaker, my government and I disagree vehemently with the Honourable Lady on many things, and we agree also just as violently on many others. But our debate is always about our differing policies and ideals and how we each think that we can better improve Gibraltar for the Gibraltarians and the residents of Gibraltar. But frankly, Mr. Speaker, to read those comments about her and to have read similar comments recently insulting on social media also the Minister for Transport, Business and the Port, the Honourable Mr. Dalianani, arising from her from his ethnicity is frankly a huge disappointment. For some to make racist and anti-Semitic remarks I suppose part of the political debate is frankly just anathema and alien to what the Gibraltar is, and frankly, Mr. Speaker, not the Gibraltar that I know and love. I always take the view, Mr. Speaker, that Mrs. Thatcher was right about one thing at least, that when they start to insult you, and when they start to attack you and not your argument, it's because whoever is insulting or attacking you has left the argument. And so, Mr. Speaker, I know that everyone in this House will want to join me in solidarity with the Honourable Lady and in ensuring that we send a very clear message from this race, that any type of racism, and indeed in particular anti-Semitism, will not be tolerated in the vote and will not be considered a part of the political debate, but something happening outside it and outside the rules. And I want to thank the Commissioner for listening to the Speaker for telling me yesterday already that he was progressing with that.
The Honourable Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Opposition, I do want to express our solidarity with our statement. Before I do, can I just ask Mr. Speaker, before, because I suspect that when I rise and Mr. Speaker, last time I spoke on a statement, to point out to me that in speaking for a statement, there needed to be questions of clarification. I suspect that I will not be seeking clarification on this statement or indeed another statement that I believe the Chief Minister is going to make this morning, but with your attitude, given the importance of the issue, Mr. Speaker, I would ask to be allowed to reply today without asking questions of clarification. And this, Mr. Speaker, our position is entirely the same in relation to issues of anti-Semitism and discrimination. We said yesterday there is absolutely no place for racism, discrimination, anti-Semitism, prejudice or intolerance in Gibraltar. And I made very clear that as a community, all citizens in our community need to make sure that we strive to respect the boundaries of proper political comment, behavior and social media. I know emotions run high sometimes, but it is important to keep within the bounds of fair and respectful and lawful comments. And of course, anything that crosses those lines into racist, religious, or any form of intolerance are entirely unacceptable and repugnant to the members that I speak for on this side of the House, and I'm sure also many members of our community. The issue of prejudice, discrimination, and focusing on differences rather than on common features that unite us, unfortunately, is a global issue and not just a local one. For many centuries, people have focused on differences rather than on similarities, whether those differences were religious or ethnic or other differences. And you see that still present in other countries when there are other issues that hit the news. In Gibraltar, we have always prided ourselves of having a homogenous, cosmopolitan community drawn from different ethnic and national backgrounds, where we have been able to develop and foster a sense of nationhood with that rich mix, that makes the Gibraltarian, because we have British Moroccan Gibraltarians and Gibraltarians who are Jews and Hindus and Catholics. And none of that makes any particular sector or person less of a Gibraltarian because they are drawn from different races originally or indeed from different nationalities or indeed from different religions. So we entirely express our solidarity and Hassanal knew that I contacted her on the day of her statement to express our views and extend our support on this issue. And I expressed indeed my concern to her privately about the fact that there are other instances of comments on social media or generally. And I gave her the example of some of our citizens of Moroccan origin who I feel also face a degree of discrimination in the comments sometimes. And the leader of the House has also mentioned comments made in respect of one of his ministers, with which we also show solidarity because we think it is unacceptable for people to make comments of that type. It is time to have robust political debate, or debate on social issues, but when people do say they need to respect the boundaries of proper and lawful behavior and not to send into comments that are either racist, prejudiced, or discriminatory against people on grounds that are entirely unconstitutional and entirely wrong. So for those reasons, I also wish to express the solidarity of members on this side of the house for the comments that have been made.
Mr. Speaker, with your indulgence, I will also be asking for exemption for clarification on the response of the statement for obvious reasons in this case. In response to the Chief Minister's statement and that of the Leader of the Opposition, which I am very grateful for, over the very distasteful and unwarranted attack on my religion this week, I would like to say that we will come in context of a wider mission, being that these comments have actually stemmed from a concerted campaign against my late father. Mr. Speaker, I'd like to say that I've always been so proud of living in a community where diversity is celebrated, where Hindus, Jews, Muslims, Christians, and people of no faith whatsoever can be friends, work colleagues, and concerned citizens together. Whatever the differences of our opinion, we have always understood that everyone wants the best for Gibraltar, but we have different ways of looking at things. The different political parties in Gibraltar have never been divided by racial or religious affiliation. How else, Mr. Speaker, could a group have been in public service for 44 years and elected for a period of over 20 years and by a Catholic majority? Mr. Speaker, it's because nobody saw colour and nobody saw religion. We are all Gibraltarian here. My father was a patriot. Everything he did for his people, not for himself. And whether you agreed with him or not, I don't think anyone can argue in good conscience that he didn't put his people first. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, it was with much sadness that I found myself defending the Hajjah Hassan smear campaign this week that has been launched for several weeks for associated purposes. Mr. Speaker, I'm not here to defend my father's policies or record, or to let history judge him for when his time as Chief Minister, but I am here to defend his memory. And people dredging up the past for their own political interests is wrong, especially, Mr. Speaker, when he has been in the grave for 25 years. So, Mr. Speaker, you won't forgive me for not allowing his memory to be tainted just so that some activists can meet their current political objectives at this very delicate moment in our history. And it is this lack of generosity and gratitude for someone who gave his life for politics and people, one of the founding fathers of Gibraltar, one of the state builders of our nation, that led me to call out such an unkind and despicable campaign of slander. So, in the end, it was the cherry on the cake of this campaign of slander that was given thrown in a gullet of anti-Semitism, which is only the side plot to this smear campaign, as I found myself accused of the age-old anti-Semitic trope of dual loyalty that has been held at Jews for millennia and was the foundation, in fact, of the expulsion of Jews from all over the world. This trope, Mr. Speaker, was used to launch the Spanish Inquisition, the Crusades, Hitler's Nazi regime, Stalin's massacres, and even unfortunately, most recently in British politics, the bullying and harassment of British Labour Tories MPs by Corbyn's Labour Party. And this week, I had to find myself at the receiving end of it as a Jew who happens to be a member of this House. Mr. Speaker, is anyone here accused of dual loyalty for marrying someone from a different nation? Is anyone here accused of dual loyalty for having a parent from a different nationality? No, Mr. Speaker, I don't believe so. Mr. Speaker, I would never tolerate and I have stood behind condemning any attempt of discrimination towards any of the minority groups in Gibraltar. And in the last few months, there has been an increase in the change of tone within the political commentaries that we see on social media. And my very good friend opposite on the government benches, the Honourable Vijay Dayanam, has also been subjected to racially charged comments. Mr. Speaker, I have to say I was not aware of this until the Chief Minister mentioned it yesterday in his press statement. and now I wish to convey my absolute and unequivocal support and solidarity to Minister Dayanani and to tell him publicly in this House that I will always roundly condemn any attack on him or on members of his community. Mr. Speaker, I wish to thank the Chief Minister for his swift condemnation yesterday of such statements and in response to my call for action to the leaders of the Parliament in this House. Similarly, I want to extend my gratitude to the Leader of the Opposition for his condemnation as well and for both her statements today. Mr. Speaker, next Monday is the most solemn day in our Jewish calendar. It is the Day of Atonement, and it is the final pleading with God for the calling of our fate for the coming year. So in this coming Day of Atonement, I will be praying for the health of every Gibraltarian, and I will also be praying that our community continues to be the paragon of tolerance, love, and respect that we have all been raised in. Thank you.
The Honourable Leader of the Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, can I thank both Honourable Members for their remarks? In particular, can I say that we are starting, we have not been able to meet other than to adjourn in this month, so we are starting this meeting in solidarity around an issue on which we have been fully in solidarity. I think the statements made by Honourable Members dovetail with the remarks I was making about the references to ethnicity and religion really having no place in the argument about ability and policy testing and ideas. I was simply rising now, Mr. Speaker, to reflect a little on what the Honourable Members said. The Honourable Leader was listening in particular talking about social media and indeed how people seem to get themselves caught under the collar when a phone is in front of a keyboard, in a way that sometimes even outdoes how in the heat of parliamentary debates we might get caught under the collar. And I do wonder whether people realise, Mr. Speaker, that in the heat of parliamentary debates we sometimes say things to each other that we might not say when the parliamentary debate is not so heated, but nonetheless, when we go behind the Speaker's chair, still continue to get on. Sometimes we might even reflect that we might have gone a little too far with the microphones on. On social media, it's a little different. What is said stays there forever, not in the way of a handshake, which is there to be consulted. It stays there forever. And I do wonder whether people might want to reflect, Mr. Speaker, that the things that they might have said in street corners to their friends before about politicians and political debate, or indeed about others, when they are said on social media, become an indelible block. If they are racist, if they are insulting, if they are anti-Semitic, they become an indelible block on that person's fingertips. The fingertips with which they have caressed the keyboard become indelibly blotted with the nonsense, the insults, and the racism and anti-Semitism that they have spewed through their fingers. And it gives them no credit for the keyboard. I was very concerned when I saw the remarks that the Honourable Lady complained about because they were direct, they were of the sort that she identified. And if I may just be permitted to say something about the doctor who's been referred to. Mr. Speaker, would that my record somehow stand like this, and that 25 years after I'm gone, people are still talking about what I did. So the character assassination of politicians in the Gaza is starting to become a sport. Well, Mr. Speaker, it's the sport where I put it to those who engage in it. The big game is bigger than any gun that can be deployed. Because the history of this place is made by those of us who are in the arena. In this place, the 17 of us who are here today, and those who have been here before us. All of us. Not one of us who might be the leader of the House today or any of the others. The 17 of us have stood up. We've stood in front of the community, we've asked for their voting support, we've got it, we're here, and we are making history. And Mr. Speaker, I'd rather be one of the men or women in the arena, one of these 17, than one of the cowards sitting at home in the shadows criticizing. And Mr. Speaker, that is all I have to say in respect to this matter, but I hope that we do not have to address them in this matter.
if I may now turn to the much more preferred matter of progress on the European Union negotiations. Mr. Speaker, and before I start, can I just say that today is Mental Health Awareness Day, and you are sitting in front of a green background, which is a magnificent way of reminding the community of that day. Mr. Speaker, despite the public health emergency that is developing, unfortunately, in Madrid, on Wednesday, I travelled to Madrid with the Deputy Chief Minister and the Attorney General to continue technical talks on the Brexit negotiations. I must apologise to you, Mr. Speaker, and to the House for not being able to arrive in Madrid on time yesterday to take the business of the House. Mr. Speaker, one of the difficulties that COVID has created is that where before there were trains almost every hour, now if you don't make the 7:30 o'clock train, you don't make it back to the south of Spain in time. So I do apologise to the House for that. In fact, Mr. Speaker, as has happened twice in the past 2 weeks, and unfortunately, as these negotiations reach their zenith, we may find in the future that we are unable to pursue also the normal parliamentary timetable during this autumn that we would like to be pursuing, which is a month in advance. Let me now turn, Mr. Speaker, to what's most likely happening. Mr. Speaker, I've repeatedly told Gibraltar that we will not permit that the European Union negotiations in the sense of a future relationship should involve any transgression of our well-known red lines on sovereignty, jurisdiction, or control over our territory. I made it clear that we will not recommend a deal to this Parliament that crosses those red lines. That remains, of course, our position. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, I will tell the House today that the Deputy Chief Minister has already set up a year in the preparation of the mechanisms we will need to activate, so we have no deal by the time the transitional period ends on the 31st of December. Last Friday, I spoke to the Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Boris Johnson, MP. I have issued a statement in respect of that conversation already, but it's worth reflecting on the adamantine support that the Prime Minister restated for Gibraltar. We are working hand in glove with the United Kingdom. We're working like clockwork with the teams at the Foreign Office and Task Force Europe in Downing Street. We're working to try to agree a deal that brings maximum security for all persons at the frontier. And we're working towards a similar deal that brings maximum security for goods passing the frontier. None of these would create a new frontier between us and between persons and goods arriving from the United Kingdom, as these are already subject to immigration and customs checks, and it would be wrong for anyone to pretend otherwise. We're working for such a deal in good faith, with all our energy and ability and with great enthusiasm. But we are not blind to the problems we face. There are political issues, there are legal issues, and there are issues, of course, of trust and confidence. But we are optimistic about also remaining realistic. And for that reason, we are also ready for no deal. But if we're still talking, Mr. Speaker, it's because we still believe that a deal, although complex and difficult, is still possible without any crossing of our red lines on sovereignty, jurisdiction, or control. We will continue to brief all honourable members of this House on the progress of the negotiations. I will be briefing the Cabinet and Mr. Gordon in detail on Monday morning. I expect to see the leader of the opposition in Mr. Sandown as soon as possible thereafter. Mr. Speaker, at this stage, I cannot say more, because there is no more to say than we have already said. But I will emphasise this. We will not recommend to this Parliament any deal that crosses our red lines on sovereignty, jurisdiction, or control. And we will not stop negotiating if we believe we can get a deal that does not cross our red lines on sovereignty, jurisdiction, or control. And let me be clear, Mr. Speaker, as I said before, any deal which affects our international status or our constitutional settlement will be put through a referendum of the people of the village. And let me be clear also, Mr. Speaker, that there is no one in the Gibraltar negotiating team who would wish to agree to any proposal that crosses our red lines in sovereignty, jurisdiction, or control, and neither is there anyone in our team who would be unable to see a legal measure that would have such an effect. So let's be clear, our red lines will not be crossed on our watch. But we will continue to negotiate, and we will return to the House to inform it and to inform our people as often as we are able to and as fully as we are able to. Thank you very much.
The Honourable the Leader of the Division.
Mr. Speaker,
we're grateful for that statement, and indeed I'm sure there's quite a lot of interest out there in respect of statements on the Brexit talks, and the post-Brexit talks. Mr. Speaker, the House knows, and indeed the Honourable Member knows, that because I have said so to him privately and indeed publicly, that the party that I lead wants there to be a positive agreement reached in respect to our future relationship with the European Union, as long as that agreement does not transgress issues, our traditional views on sovereignty, jurisdiction, and control. And of course, as we have, I think, both observed, the devil is in the detail of the package of agreements that may emerge, and indeed, maybe no agreement emerges. And so it is absolutely right that the government should prepare in parallel for no deal, because in the eventuality of no deal, Gibraltar must be ready. And people will not understand that we are not ready if it gets to the 31st of December 2020, because we have had 4.5 years since the referendum. And the government down here appreciates that. And that's not a loaded political comment, it's a comment because of the passage of time. People would expect whatever government or whatever political complexion is in place to have ensured, while it negotiates, to also prepare for no deal, because that is a potential reality. The other day, there were commentators mentioning that we were, this week, have passed the point that we were 100 days away from the 31st of December. So we have now less than 100 days to either contribute or not. And I appreciate the exercise that the government is engaged in. And I know the sensitivity of those discussions. And indeed I know that it is important to have faith to negotiate. And the Honourable Member knows that we in the position have given the government political space to conduct those discussions while he has been briefing us on progress, and that we are continuing to give him space to conduct those negotiations. We understand that is important for Gibraltar, and we do so not because we are taking our foot off the political accelerator and letting the government have a free pass, but because when we give them space to negotiate, it is because we consider it to be in the interest of the voter for that space to be there. Quite a different matter is to also comment, as we did this week, on agreements that have been reached, historic ones. And I'm not going to go into that, but I think it's important for people to understand that it is a very different matter to comment on speculation and proposals rather than to comment on agreements that are put down on black and white paper and have actually been reached to live with. And we have historic and consistent views on that. That is not to say that we do not want there to be a deal, because we do want there to be a positive, safe agreement for Gibraltar in respect of the future relationship. It is important that whatever emerges, if something emerges, in the next less than 100 days, for it to be safe. And we will, as I have said previously before, we will scrutinize the package of a great agreement that emerges, if a package emerges, and then make up our own assessment of whether agreements that emerge are safe and good for the voting. Chief Minister already indicated this week that he would intend to table, I'm not sure if he said proposed agreement, but this is perhaps something he could tell us, to table proposed agreements or agreements that have been reached in the Parliament. Whatever is the case, of course, it will give us the opportunity. I imagine he meant agreements that have been reached in Parliament. It will give us the opportunity to precisely have that public debate on the issue, and I certainly welcome that the Parliament could get that opportunity on an issue as important as this. So,
I understand the Chief Minister's tone and desire not to explain publicly in greater detail what discussions are having, because I appreciate also there will be a moving feast of decisions, and it probably is not helpful to divert the position. There is, I am sure, and I see it on social media, a thirst for knowledge. And that is also understandable, and so it is a balancing exercise to ensure that the public are given information, which is important that they can have, as to the kind of discussions that are happening, while not providing details that might prejudice Gibraltar's interest, and indeed, therefore, their own interest in obtaining secure safe agreements as to the future. So from this side of the House, Mr. Speaker, we welcome the statement, understand why it is fairly cautious and low on content, and we will continue to give the government space in the negotiations while still playing vigorously and robustly our role as the opposition in scrutinising anything that emerges and ensuring that it is within and respects the fundamentals that we are standing.
Would you see something like the country? Then turn it on.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, together with Brunei have been supportive of the government in its attempt to obtain a deal that can guarantee fluidity for both goods and parties at the border come end of December. We understand that it is vital for our community that this happens, for our economy and also for our health and happiness, as well as obviously for the human bonds that exist between us and our neighbours in La Línea on the Campo de Gibraltar. We have been vocal about our support because we believe that creating a toxic political environment right now can hinder these kinds of good faith negotiations, as we have seen in the past. So we have very clear red lines, Mr. Speaker. As to government, we do not believe that Spain policing our points of entry is acceptable. It would be a clear concession of control and sovereignty that would be absolutely unpalatable for the people in our community, even when presented, if presented, with a balanced cost-benefit analysis. So a neutral context option, as suggested by the Chief Minister, would perhaps be a compromise, although some work has to be done to rebuild the trust and the reputation of EU institutions that, after the very confused messaging, people have been exposed to throughout the Brexit ordeal. Mr. Speaker, we're also wary of what implications entry into Schengen would bring to our economy, and whether significant changes to our taxation system will actually be necessary in order to level the playing field. We would like to hear government projections of the impact of losing our VAT free status and whether other tax and tariffs might have to be modified. Also, we would like to know what plans would be in place to support our already busted private sector through these important administrative changes. So in sum, Mr. Speaker, we continue to support the efforts to achieve a deal while remaining extremely cautious. And we look forward to future briefings and we wish the government the best of luck in these negotiations. Personally, and as a party, we hope that all members of this chamber understand the predicament that we find ourselves in and live up to the moment and not fall into the trap of exploiting this moment in time to the detriment of the people of the Gibraltar, because I am sure that this period is doing harsh judgment in such communities. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I am grateful to both Honourable Members for the statements that they have made, and I think the Honourable Ladies did request some clarification, so I'll deal with that also. The Honourable Lady is right that the people would not forgive us if we were not ready for an idea because we've had 4.5 years notice that it might happen. She's absolutely right about that.
the Deputy Chief Minister is in charge of Radio England, and like I said in my statement, he is stepping up a gear already in preparation. But we have to understand what being ready for an AGM means. There is nothing that the Deputy Chief Minister and the whole of the government with him can do if there is no deal to ensure that the 1st of January is the same as the 31st of December. So, it will not be possible for anybody to credibly say, I can't get my teeth across in the way I used to before. I'm having to queue for an hour and a half. I'm having to have my passport stamped. What's going on? Weren't you ready? You had 4.5 years. It will not be possible to say, it's the fault of the Deputy Chief Minister, and it's the fault of the government, and it's the fault of the Chief Minister, it's the fault of the whole parliament. No. This is the fault of Brexit in the absence of a deal. Because that is what Brexit means in the absence of a new deal with the European Union. It could mean no fresh milk in the supermarket. It could mean no perishable goods in the United Kingdom being able to arrive in the time available for the goods to be used. This is what the absence of a deal could mean. And there are no preparations that you can put in place from the unilateral position of Gibraltar to sort those things out. Let's be clear about that now. Let's not pretend on the morning of the 2nd of January to say as a community, our administration has let us down. There's no deal and there's a queue at the frontier. There's no deal and there's no fresh milk. There's no deal and let's understand what the absence of a deal means. We fully understand it on this side of the house and we're ready for it. And we're ready to face down anyone who thinks that we will do a deal that crosses our red line because we're not ready to face up to what no deal means. We know what no deal means and we're ready to face up to no deal. And we're prepared to do the maximum that can be done in the absence of a deal to mitigate and to provide contingencies in those eventualities. That's what we have to understand. And I know that the leader of Mr. Bully understands that, and I'm grateful for the opportunity and the way that he's presented his response to my statement today to explain it more widely, because I know that he would know that it would be lacking in credibility at a political level to be criticising the government on the 2nd of January for those things. And I'm not suggesting that you would be doing so, but I think it is important that the community understands what it means. And the community understands that as the sentinel of the red lines that all of us consider to be uncrossable, everybody needs to be ready for what the consequences of that are, because that is where we are leading the community. We are leading this community to no deal if anybody dares to think that we will cross a red line for a deal. Be clear about that, because we're ready for it. And that's the direction of travel that we are embarked upon. And I'm grateful, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman also says, and I think that, that this is the right position to take, that we are giving us space to do the deal that is still possible, that avoids that situation. And that does not mean a free pass. Of course it doesn't. When we look at the things that we bring, they already provide comments when we show them the material that we're dealing with, and we're open to further comment from them and ideas from them and all of the issues that we discuss. And I absolutely get that that's not a free pass, and that they reserve the right to criticize what we might then decide is a recommendable deal, or it might decide that it's not a recommendable deal, and they may decide it's a recommendable deal, and they might say, well, we would have done it, and people need to understand that there's no deal because the BFF Liberals won't do it, but we would have done that deal. And this could be cut in many different permutations by the time that there is a deal on the table, or as much of a deal as there could be on the table by the time we walk away, and they might say they might have continued negotiating. So I fully get that it's not a free pass. And I also appreciate Mr. Speaker's clarification that his comments this week were about old agreements and not current agreements, although he knows, Mr. Speaker, that I believe that he is both legally and politically wrong when he says that it was possible, that it was negotiable in the first round, to do a deal on movement for Gibraltar, simply because there was a deal of movement for Northern Ireland. And I think it's important that people do understand that. because the Great Deal of Movement in Northern Ireland predated the European Union in the context of Schengen and mobility issues. And what is happening in respect of Northern Ireland is that the common travel area is remaining, because Ireland is not in Schengen. So it's not that a deal of mobility was negotiated for Northern Ireland, the kind that we have failed to negotiate in the first stage. If he fully knows, I have too much respect for his intellect to think that he doesn't understand this, and I do appreciate that he doesn't really decide he wants to make the point politically. But what is happening in Northern Ireland is that they're reverting to the situation as it was ante quo, which is the common travel area in Northern Ireland and Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom, because there were never any Schengen issues there, because Ireland is not in Schengen. What we're negotiating is totally different, and it's only negotiable and only on the table in the context of a future relationship. So I'm grateful that everyone wanted to deal with that today, but as we referred to the comments we had made and that they were about the old agreement, that is what he knows is my answer to his argument in that respect. And I think in his position on wanting a deal and not wanting a deal, in other words, wanting a deal only with his faith, is exactly the same position as ours. I think that it's the honourable lady's position as well, and I come and deal with what she said about these things now. But I think we all also need to agree that if we come with a deal, Mr. Speaker, it will be a deal that we have carefully calibrated to ensure that there are no concessions whatsoever, no crossing of red lines. And then the question will be to say, and the key for all of us will be, Mr. Speaker, not to try and pretend that there might be a crossing of red lines of relations. And I'm sure that given the approaches we have today, we won't fall into those traps, and neither will any other member of the House. But what I'm saying to the rest of the community, in other words, to those beyond, to the commentators, that this is a very serious, complex, difficult negotiation for the whole of Europe and the United Kingdom, in particular for Little Gibraltar. There are clear red lines, they will not be crossed. If we bring a deal, it's because it doesn't cross those lines. Of course, we cannot be the sole judges of that. Everybody needs to be able to be satisfied with that to their own standards. But it would be disingenuous for people in the community to look at concessions where they do not agree. And they will need to understand the agreement in the context of the level of complexity of European law and of international treaty law, because it will not be an easy thing to decipher, and there will be many cross-references to be done before anybody can believe that they have understood what it is that we might be able to come back with. Mr. Speaker, anything that we do, however, will be ad referenda the Cabinet, the Council of Ministers. We will not agree anything unless it is approved by the whole Council of Ministers. And then we will bring here that with the Council of Ministers as agreed, which is a normal way. Now, I'm grateful that the Honourable Gentleman has also understood that the reason why I am unable to say more as to substance here today, although I would say more as to substance to the Council of Ministers and to the Honourable Lady and to the Honourable Gentleman, as soon as we're able to, in the context of our briefing, is because we're in the middle of negotiations. But I think he will know from what he has been told more privately that I am giving the skeleton, the outline, the bones of what it is that is being discussed with as much detail as possible. He says that he thinks there's a thirst for knowledge out there. Of course, I do understand that there is a desire to know more. But I think that there is a desire to be assured that there will be no crossing of red lines, and that there isn't even a countenance in the crossing of red lines going on in the room. Well, Mr. Speaker, in that respect, I would just refer the House and the community to a statement made in the context of the majority by the then Secretary of State in Spain to Europe, Marco Aguilar, who said, "We are fully aware that if you were to table anything to do with sovereignty, the Gibraltarians would cross their files, close their files, and walk out." There is a new Secretary of State in Spain now, Mr. Speaker. I can tell you by the news that he and all of the hierarchy from those that we are dealing with fully understand that and appreciate that when we simply close our files and walk out with anything that even suggested to cross one of our red lines or to affect sovereignty. So the community can have that absolute assurance from us as a speaker. If anything is right, it would not be helpful to say more at this stage, but I'm very happy to give those assurances. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Lady was gracious in lending us support for and assistance for the negotiations. She was grateful. And she has identified that we have been very clear in the context of the past few months that anybody who thought that it would be acceptable to have Spanish law enforcement agents, whether they're police officers or whether they're anybody else, on Gibraltar, would not have understood where our red lines have been for generations. And Mr. Speaker, that is not something that we would ever countenance, and it is not something that we would ever imagine being able to consider agreeable, let alone that we would bring it as agreed to Gibraltar. So, Mr. Speaker, nobody needs to have any concerns whatsoever that that is something that we would agree. There is the issue of context, which I referred to previously, and which has led to comments by the Honourable Lady Fair and by the Honourable Gentleman in some recent public interventions. We are as alive to the benefits of a potential context intervention as a European institution as to the potential dangers of a context intervention and who makes that context and in what capacity they make that context. So we are fully alive to those issues, and we would not allow our red lines to disclose or to be crossed. Sorry, by a back door, but there are possibilities in respect of Frontex-driven agency and what it might be able to do. Mr. Speaker, there are no tax implications in the context of the Fingon debate, which the Honourable Lady has spoken about. There might be tax implications in the context of the Common Customs Union, but not in respect of services. There will be absolutely no consequences on services, no VAT on services. That is not something that we would countenance. The exercise of whether or not there could be a customs union benefit in respect of goods is a live one where we have views and we would be prepared to consider some aspects of membership. Some aspects of membership would not be beneficial to the world and we would not propose them. And that would require reorganization of our tax system, which would in itself be something which would require a very deep consultation in the world. It wouldn't be something that we could do now because we would not know the shape of the proposed customs union integration until we reach the end of the negotiation, and that would be more in the nature of a proposal for consideration and discussion with the business community in the data. There would be very long conditional provisions in respect of that, which would mean, Mr. Speaker, that there would be plenty of time to consider and then, if necessary, adjust. But you don't need to be a rocket scientist to be betraying any negotiation to know that being in the Common Customs Union would potentially create some new issues for Gibraltar, which we have to develop with, and that could only be something that we would be prepared to do if we believe that the benefits of that far outweigh the very difficulties. And the reason I'm not recommending that to the community today is because we haven't made that determination, because the state of what is proposed is not yet finalized, and therefore there is nothing to assess in any serious and meaningful way. But there would be definitely a consultation with our business community in that respect. Mr. Speaker, I thank honourable members for their contribution, and I assure the community that we will put all our energy, enthusiasm, and ability in continuing to seek a negotiated a new deal for the border with the European Union after the 31st of December, so long as it is clear that such a new deal cannot cross the red lines, and we are ready, Mr. Speaker, on this side of the House for no deal, and everything that it will imply if we are unable to reach the deal.
Papers to be made, the Honourable Deputy Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to lay on the table a letter recording the written agreement between myself and the Leader of the Opposition,
as to the time period provided for in Section 82 of the Appropriation Act 2019, such that this be extended to the last day of December 2020, that is to say by a further 92 days, I believe, because we'll hear more about that in the context of my intervention now in the Appropriation Act. In order to account for the Water Regulatory Authority for the year ended the 31st of March 2020, the annual report of the Water Police Authority for the year ended the 31st of March 2020, the Integrated Tariff Amendment Regulation 2020, the Integrated Tariff Amendment Number 2 Regulation 2020, the Integrated Tariff Amendment Number 3 Regulation 2020, and the Integrated Tariff Amendment Number 4 Regulation 2020.
Ordered to rise.
The Honourable Minister for Digital, Financial Services and Public Utilities. Report and orders of the Times, which is brought to Broadcasting Corporation for the years ending 31st of March 2013, 31st of March 2014, 31st of March 2015, 31st of March 2016, 31st of March 2017, 31st of March 2018, 31st of March 2019, and the 31st of March 2020.
Order to rise.
Bill, first and second reading. A bill for an act to amend the Appropriation Act 2019, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
I have the honour to move the Bill for an Act to amend the Appropriation Act 2019 be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a Bill for an Act to amend the Appropriation Act 2019 be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Appropriation Act 2019, Amendment Number 2 Act 2020.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, before I go into the general principles and merits of the bill, let me just confirm to the Parliament, as I've now stated, that I've written to you, Mr. Speaker, confirming that this bill was too urgent to wait for the instruction of 6 weeks since its publication before it could be considered by the House, and I table also a letter on the extension of the period referred to in Section 8 of this bill, which I will come to in a few moments. Mr. Speaker, the purpose of this bill is to further extend the current financial year period by another 6 months. In fact, Mr. Speaker, this bill comes before the Parliament in the same week as the Parliament in Westminster has been advised by the Chancellor, the Honourable Right Honourable Rishi Sunak, also that the Commons in the United Kingdom will not be taking a budget this year. The times we're living through are so extraordinary that the House of Commons in the United Kingdom, the mother of all parliaments, where parliamentary budgetary traditions began, will this year not consider its spending plans in its annual Section State of the Nation budget debate. This decision has been a surprise to many and featured yesterday's breaking news in many of the UK's 24-hour roving news channels. Here, Mr. Speaker, there should be no such surprise for members of this House or for businesses and members of the public who watch carefully for budgetary announcements. Of course, the bill we are debating has now been published for some weeks, and people have been aware of it, although, as I've confirmed at the start of my intervention, I've specified it as urgent under the Constitution. As a result, Mr. Speaker, members of the House and members of the public have had full and transparent notice from the government of the legislative detail of our intention for some weeks now. There is no surprise there, Mr. Speaker. Additionally, Mr. Speaker, both you and all honourable members opposite will recall that in my intervention in the March session of this House, when we originally prorogued our 1920 budget for 6 months, I had already highlighted the possibility of there being the need to seek a further extension to the financial year, which is what we're doing today. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, the Financial Secretary and I have already discussed the possibility of the leader of the opposition and the Shadow Minister for Financial Services. I've also already alerted the Honourable Mr. Sam Nowen to the possibility. Now, Mr. Speaker, as the additional time we have submitted ourselves under the first March extension, which is coming to an end at the end of September, this further extension is both operationally necessary and additionally will help the House to restore the financial year end to the historic customary financial year end of the 31st of March. I'm confident, Mr. Speaker, given our discussions to date, that honourable members of the will agree this is the right thing to do. Not least, Mr. Speaker, because of the ability to understand spending, estimate, and the budget generally, when we come to our next full budget debate, well, it will be easier also for the general public to judge our spending discipline by reference to a simple doubling of the cost of the administration, rather than having to consider performance over a multiplier of 1.5. A simple multiplier of 2 will be much easier for the purposes of understanding the spending over the 24-month period, as well as the performance over the 2 12-month periods covered by the 1921 budget, as it will in effect now be. In terms of process, Mr. Speaker, we plan to return to the traditional budgetary process as from the 1st of April 2021. The effect of this will be that we will present our budgetary estimate, also known more colloquially as the estimates book, for the next financial year before and not later than 30 days after the commencement of the financial year in accordance with Section 69 of the Constitution. This is the traditional manner of proceeding since the change of financial year in 1971, I believe, by the integration of the Britain government, and a tradition followed since then until this extraordinary year. So the procedure, as honourable members will now see as I go into the body of this address, what a year is about to become a flexible concept. This estimate book, Mr. Speaker, will therefore, as from April, contain the estimates for the year ending the 31st of March 2022 and the forecast outturn for the 2-year period ending on the 31st of March 2021. This latter period is the one significantly affected by the COVID pandemic, and let's hope that the future will be the only one significantly affected by the COVID pandemic. We've already set out how this might look structurally to incorporate something known as the COVID-19 Response Fund, and to enable members of the House and the public more generally to understand the costs that relate directly to the pandemic and those that relate to normal government spending. We have already had detailed discussions, which include a mock-up of the estimates book as it will be, with the leader of the opposition and the Shadow Minister for Public Finance, of how the estimates book will be presented to incorporate the COVID-19 Response Fund, and on the manner in which we have set out the detail of the fund, which will be published now on a regular basis. We're going to provide full transparency and disclosure in respect of these numbers so that everyone in the community now can see how the spending power of the nation has been deployed in order to deal with the financial cost of dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. The aim, Mr. Speaker, is to restore normality to this process, leading up to the traditional budgetary debate next June or July, in the usual way. This helps us speak in terms of expediency and administration, as well as providing a consistent approach for the presentation and analysis of estimate-related statistics. This is the point I make, Mr. Speaker. It is going to be far easier to make a comparison of 2 years with one, as opposed to preparing a book containing a forecast outcome for 1.5 years, another book for a 6-month year, and then go back producing books for a whole year. As you know, the earlier bill, which we dealt with in the emergency budget in March, provided departments, agencies and authorities other than the Gibraltar Authority with an additional 50% of their 2019-20 recurrent budget for that first 6-month extension of the budget. The position was simply that we were adding half a year to the financial year. We were adding 50% more to the monies available to the departments in that period. The Gibraltar Health Authority was provided with more than just 50%. We were then at the start of the pandemic, and we therefore needed more than just 50% for the Gibraltar Health Authority, and we added that additional amount as needed. We added more for the further emergency funding in order to help ensure that the GSK would definitely be able to meet all COVID-19 costs it might encounter.
in the rest of what we politically know as the book, in the pink pages, the improvement and development fund allocation was limited in the March emergency budget to an increase of under 27% on the original 1920 budget. These amounts are calculated based on a project-by-project assessment of overall requirements. This followed an unscientific assessment of indicative costs, less of revenue and assumptions of capital projects. At that time, it then had to be curtailed or stopped as a result of the COVID pandemic. And therefore, given that vein, the building presented today broadly follows once again the line taken with the March 2020 amendment bill. The majority of the proposed consolidated fund allocation has seen the same level of increase, which means that the original 1920 allocation is now in effect simply doubled to cover a 2-year period, and as such, has not seen any budgetary growth. The only exception is our Head 18 for education, Head 28 for health, Head 29 for the Water Health Authority, and Elderly Residential Services. The first of those is the DHA simplicity, and the second of them is the Elderly Residential Services aspect of the health care. The extra funding for the Gibraltar Health Authority and the Elderly Residential Services section is largely, of course, to cover ongoing COVID-related expenses, whilst the requirement for the Education Department is to cater for the estimated shortfall deriving largely from the salary increases for teachers, which happened after the original 1920 budget, had been debated in the past, and higher than budget for educational grant funding, something which we consider to be demand-led to the extent that we have now introduced mandatory grants for second degree. This latter expense, alongside health, Mr. Speaker, is undoubtedly the best investment we make and is a key part of the economic strategy introduced in the late 80s by Sir Joseph Hannah and which we share in great degree today. We must preserve that for the future also, and in a fuller budget address next year, I hope to be able to deal with how we create the funds for that. Mr. Speaker, this bill also includes provision for the $150 million contribution to the COVID-19 response fund. This addition is an inclusion to ensure that the format of the estimate put going forward can correctly reflect the interaction with this fund. The aim is to ensure that the book will include presentation of the reference to this fund in such a way that the user can identify those costs that relate directly to the pandemic. I'm looking at the user nodding his head, I'm pleased to say, Mr. Speaker. Looking directly at the cost that relate directly to the pandemic and the departments, agencies and authorities that have incurred this necessary spending. The Gazette, which will be issued later today, will show the spending to the end of June on the COVID-19 response. I shared this with honourable members opposite ahead of its publication and provided them with current and more up-to-date data. Key highlights that this community needs to understand are as follows. Revenue lost or forgone by government in the period to the 30th of June 2020, arising from the pandemic, stood at around £59 million. That is the same figure. We would have received an extra almost £60 million if it were not for COVID. Total costs directly related to this pandemic stood at £23 million. That is to say, we had to spend £23 million we would not otherwise have spent on the cost of materials, services, etc., that we had to deploy only because of the COVID pandemic. Of these costs, around £11.3 million relates to deep payments. This is money, in our view, Mr. Speaker, very well spent with the agreement of this House in ensuring that everyone who works here to live in our prosperity in the good times is guaranteed receipt of at least the minimum wage in the months of total lockdown. We were committed, Mr. Speaker, to protecting working people. And we did, Mr. Speaker, and we continue to do so. Let me tell the House, the quarterly average number of persons registered as unemployed in Gibraltar for the end of September, calculated as at the close of business today, will likely be 15. The quarterly average at the end of September last year was 42. We set out, Mr. Speaker, to create jobs and working people, and we have.
of the 11.3 million arrived further above in the sector of B, 1.5 million related to capital costs such as the setup of Nightingale with all of its associated costs. I've made a mistake. Of the 11.3 million I referred to was related to capital costs not to be, 1.5 million was the cost of setting up Nightingale. A lot of money, Mr. Speaker, for a facility we have not yet used and we all hope we will not have to use. But this is money we had to spend or we would not have been ready for the onslaught that we might have or we might still have in coming up money. The balance left on the fund of 1.8 million therefore equates to the money donated, raised by charitable donations, or clawed back from student grants. A determination has been made on how best to apply these money for which for the moment are being kept in the COVID-19 response fund itself. I want to thank everyone who selflessly returned money or donated to this cause. I will say more about that later in my presentation. In essence, Mr. Speaker, the above reflects that the synergy has required an additional borrowing placed within the fund, which at the 30th of June stood at £81.8 million. To date, borrowing has needed to be increased to the full capacity of the current income limit of £150 million, which is the facility where we refer to the House in the emergency budget at the end of March. It is important that this House and the public should be aware and confident that the government is well prepared to make costs beyond this should this be required. There will be no funding shortfall of necessary expenditure. We have the financial firepower to make necessary expenditure. I think it is important that we point this to regret that our estimate so far has been very accurate. Estimating is not a science, it is an art. But the Office of the Financial Secretary delivered excellent results of outstanding against customers. The prediction of £150 million for the period to the end of the budget extension period has been bang on near target. These are the figures we shared our thinking on with the leader of the opposition, the Shadow Minister for Public Finance, and I think it is fair to say, although they will be able to speak for themselves in the course of this debate, that they could see from the data that we presented why the financial sector view suggested these would be the correct amount. I want to thank the financial secretary for this aspect of his work, although we also have something to say later in respect of the work being done in the Treasury, and also the shadow member for public finance for his engagement with us on this process of budget extension and the creation and presentation of the COVID response fund. Mr. Speaker, it's important that this House and the community at large understand the financial impact of this pandemic. It means that government finances are being squeezed from both ends, from two sides. Revenue is significantly down, whereas costs and items we would not otherwise have incurred is significantly up. We are making less money and we're spending more money. And this is not for a political or partisan debate or disagreement with honourable members on all sides have properly appreciated, and I thank them for it. This is about inability to trade on the one hand and requirement to spend on essentials for our community on the other. It's too early to tell where this is headed, particularly given the impact this virus is having in other countries where different steps are being taken, all of which curtail normal activity and which impact on economic activity and is ultimately reflected in our government receipts, the most obvious of which is tourism. The good news, such as it may be, is that we're seeing that costs necessary to be incurred as a result of the pandemic are levelling off, whereas income, while significantly down on a year-by-year comparison, is showing signs of some recovery. We also have other costs which are not being incurred as a result of the pandemic, so we're heading in the right direction. Nevertheless, I want to be clear. At the end of this process, Gibraltar will be left with an economy it needs to reinvigorate, and a debt arising from this crisis in excess of £150 million. That is not a debt of anyone's making. It's not a debt of political or partisan genesis. This is the freestanding amount of the cost of COVID for this community. We're right to have borrowed at this time in order to ensure that we continue to see our businesses and employees supported throughout the period. Indeed, at the same time as we've seen these difficulties that COVID has created, we've also seen a further drop in the interest rates payable on borrowing, also work closely to ensure that our borrowing can be at historically low rates. This means our borrowing can be cheaper and more affordable than ever, even at commercial rates. So we will need to be at our most agile and most innovative if we are to re-establish ourselves at levels of activity and consequent revenue that we enjoyed before the pandemic. Together, I remain confident that with the Gibraltarian spirit and ingenuity, we will get there. Mr. Speaker, this is written to the Leader of the Opposition, proposing the agreement that the period provided for in Section 8.2 of the Appropriation Act, which we are amending today, should be further extended for a period of days to the 31st of December 2020, covering the next quarter of this calendar year. This section empowers me, Section 8, empowers me to make any regulations and amend any primary or secondary legislation as may be necessary to put in place measures to assist businesses, registered employers, employees, and self-employed persons during the pandemic. This is the mechanism by which I have created the regulations that provided for our these measures. In this respect, I tabled the agreement with the Leader of the Opposition myself in Parliament today. I'm pleased to have been able to agree with the extension with him. Mr. Speaker, I maintain my previous statement to the House that this is a power that I will use sparingly, and I continue to assure the House that I undertake to use the power only as exceptionally required only. Mr. Speaker, as a result of that power, and in order to continue to assist our businesses through what will undoubtedly continue to be a difficult autumn, the following huge measures will be continued. Discounts on rents and rates will continue for the fourth quarter of this year. This provides a 25% discount on rates, which, when added to the early repayment discount already in place, allows traders to take advantage of a total discount of 50% on rates. On rents, the continuation means that government rents continue to be reduced by 50% and private rents reduced by a 25% at least. Additionally, all rental increases will continue to be suspended by the government until the 1st of April 2021. Our tables and chairs license fees will continue to be waived by the government in their entirety. We will continue to encourage that private landlords to provide at least a 50% discount on such license fees. Adjustments to import duty will continue at least until the end of the fourth quarter of the year. And finally, Mr. Speaker, the government's hugely successful deep measures will be continued. The deep 3.0 measures, which provided 20% of average fee payment in the first half of the operation of it, will continue for October and November for those firms who have complied with their deep 3.0 conditions and are complying with all other relevant guidelines and rules. The government's intention is that these payments should not continue for December. We will have to assess that still at this point. In that context, Mr. Speaker, I'm convening a meeting of CELAC for next week to discuss outstanding matters of concern to unions and employer representative organizations. I had hoped, Mr. Speaker, to meet CELAC this week, but I hadn't expected to have to spend 48 hours in the group. CELAC meetings will become a regular fortnightly event for the next 2 months, at least as we monitor the autumn business environment closely with our partners in the private sector. Mr. Speaker, these are the only measures that we will provide for in this extension of the budget period. As in the United Kingdom, we will have no other budget or budget measures this year of the type usually provided for during a normal budget session. I commend, Mr. Speaker, that those should be the measures that this Parliament should approve in the context of this extension. But, Mr. Speaker, in doing so, I want to reflect on this. But when we first reported to the House the result of the Brexit referendum in June 2016, it looked like that would be the biggest challenge of the face. Little did we know or imagine that in the last days of Brexit, a virus pandemic would conspire with it to make the challenges we face in the community even harder than everyone might imagine. This is a speaker perhaps, therefore, the perfect storm of political reasons. So when I rose to make my budget address barely 72 hours after the referendum results had been announced, I told Gibraltar one thing which has been proved right over and over again. I told this Parliament and our nation that it was time for some of our extraordinary people to do extraordinary things. And they have, Mr. Speaker. In these moments of our greatest need, in these moments of our greatest challenge, in these moments of sometimes grim potential for failure, our best people have shown the best of themselves. It is thanks to that great performance by so many
that we are here today able to look forward with equal measures of caution, prudence, but also optimism. Because to face the challenge, we did not wither, sicken, or die as a nation. We have grown, risen to the challenge, and given heart to progress. I said we would see extraordinary people do extraordinary things for Gibraltar, but little did I know how much we would ask of them. From the front line in the health authority to the trenches of the Treasury, we have seen the best of the Gibraltar that I know and love in the past 6 months from some of the best in Gibraltar. In particular, the civil contingency team led by the lobby base of number 6 has done sterling round the clock work. The public and civil service and the administration of Gibraltar have risen beyond the challenges before them. Doctors, nurses, law technicians, cleaners, street cleaners, clerks, you name it, from every level, there has been support for every level. They have strained every fibre. They have gone the extra mile. They have done more than any job description can ever provide for or set out. And many, Mr. Speaker, not even recording or charging overtime. My team at number 6 have charged no overtime for the work they have done. No one at number 6 has. Not because they were asked not to, but because they decided not to. So we may be experiencing problems with counties and other services. We're trying to deal properly and safely with an unprecedented situation. But on behalf of the people of Gibraltar who I represent, I say thank you to all the public servants of Gibraltar for their efforts in these extraordinary past 6 months. I thank you all. The respect that you have earned will rightly last for many, many years. As is the tradition, Mr. Speaker, I give long speeches in this place, especially at budget time, but I am speechless and humble in the face of their efforts and their achievements. Those who regularly criticize the public sector should sit up and take notice. Those who criticize government for the sake of it should sit up and take notice. When the history of this time and generation is written, writ large will be the work of those public servants who went to the front line on the war on COVID and did not charge their hours. Those few, a handful, who complained, who sought extra allowances people in the private sector were going without, or seeing salaries halved or worse, well, they are no more than a footnote to the history of the great majority of our great people and our great public sector. Those always asking for more should know that they are in a minority. The majority were quietly donating and helping. The selfish and the greedy were eclipsed by the selfless and committed. That, Mr. Speaker, filled my heart with pride, with joy, and with the rocket fuel to continue even in our darkest moments, and there were many, Mr. Speaker. Moments of real darkness at the prospect of what might overcome us. And in that context, Mr. Speaker, the work of the private sector and the work of our entrepreneurs has also been quite remarkable. The resilience of our traders, the honesty with which the almost entire majority have claimed and handled details, the way that stores have remained open or trading online, the way we have not had to go without anything in our supermarkets. Thank you also to our private sector for your contribution these challenging months. We continue to provide the infrastructure of society. You continue to operate, and you kept this old garrison town fed and watered, lifted and supplied. Thank you also in the private sector for continuing to get up early each day and continuing to provide services. News and newspaper editors, bread and cake makers, carers, grocers and suppliers, and our modern marvels, the delivery men and women who brought these things home on bike, come rain or shine. Our thank you to them all. And thank you also to all those individuals and organizations who made donations to the Gibraltar Health Authority. We did not seek donations, but we had to open an account to receive them because they were flooding in. That is the generosity of the Gibraltarian spirit once again this round. Now, Mr. Speaker, we get to do it all again. Without a lockdown, which we will seek to avoid at all costs, in the autumn and winter months to come, we need to be alive to the danger that still left the money. Because let us be clear, none of this is over, especially for the government. As we start this autumn and career towards the 31st of December, we have to be, and we will be, at the top of our game. We don't get to be
fed up of Brexit, and we don't get to be fed up of COVID. We have to address both each day between now and the end of the year at least with the same urgency and aggression as we did the first day. We have the stamina to do so. Every one of us in our community must know. We shall overcome these challenges. We shall beat the odds, Mr. Speaker. We shall be ready for any eventuality. And next year, we will return for a budget session that will once again be an opportunity for this Parliament to reflect on the state of the nation. A state which I know will be strong, proud, and turning once again together to face the threat as an individual.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? Honourable, the leader of the position.
Mr. Speaker, in that we agree with the member's office, we agreed in effect not to have a budget because of the COVID pandemic. It was a special time, not just for the Baltic, but indeed for the whole world. I said publicly, we had that conversation on the 13th of March, and we were a week later in this house agreeing that in an unprecedented way, we would have not had a budget for the first time in living constitutional memory for this community. Kicking it forward in a way that had not been done before. We did this because of the COVID emergency, and it was absolutely the right thing to do. But when we come back to this house 6 months later, it really is not a case of where we were in March, and that's also an important factor to take account of. The reason to the legislature why we now do this is more a case of administrative convenience, expedience, and indeed for us to go back to what would be the traditional way of doing things next year. Because, not least, for the reasons we're keeping us going it's important to go back to and end the financial year 31st of March, because that would allow comparisons in a traditional way going forward into the future as we have in the past. That's an important factor for us. In doing so, and in supporting this bill for this extension of 6 months, I want the honourable member opposite to understand that we would expect that things would revert to normality as from March next year, in terms at least of the budgetary process. And we know that we have worked together in respect of the budgetary matters, as we already indicated, but from our position, we would expect that the House to revert to the normal practice when we get to the end of the staggered 2 year period, so that we can have a proper budget next year. The backdrop of what we did in March was the COVID emergency. Very seriously, we had to adapt to a new environment. Gibraltar was unprepared. We bought for the health service time to invest in resources, time to invest in backup plans, in fallback areas like the Nightingale Hospital that was announced. We made sure that this community was protected, we made sure that our people were protected, we made sure that we invested in institutions so that we could take care of the worst effects of the COVID emergency, which we have been spared of. And that is a mark of the work of many, many people. But of course, I also acknowledge public servants out there who worked relatively during that period and make sure that we were prepared for the COVID emergency and invested and adjusted and made sure that we were able and we were prepared if the worst effect came to deal with. Luckily, we made an application, make sure that we were fair, so that as indeed the Chief Minister has said, the COVID emergency is still out there. But in reflecting on that, and in reflecting indeed on the budget and the figures that are being announced today, it is important also to understand and appreciate that lockdown took its toll. Lockdown took its toll on the community financially. It also took its toll on the restriction of natural freedom. And it may have taken its toll in suffering issues of mental well-being for us, that we've spoken about before. Not for today, but important to reflect and appreciate all that. Lockdown has taken a severe financial effect on the data. And when we think about that, it's important when we look at this budget, what we're doing and what we intend to do going forward, because COVID is still out there, globally, and there is no apparent end to the COVID emergency, we're just going into different phases. It's important to understand and reflect that we must now adjust to this new environment. The idea that we might gravitate, as in some areas, we're now seeing around the world, second lockdowns because they have more cases and so on, is something that we need to be careful about and shy away from. The thought of a situation which, in public health terms, takes us to an environment where the health service is under real strain and in a small community like it also with land scarcity, it is impossible for us to contain the extension of COVID, and there is real pressure on the sustainability of public services. Short of that, looking forward, we should avoid a lockdown, and we need to work within a new environment. And the reason I say that is because the lockdown and the COVID emergency has taken a financial toll. The Chief Minister has said that by the end of this period, the staggered 2 years, in effect, we will have invested $150 million in the cost of COVID. There needs to be a reality check, a financial reality check, across the board, and people need to understand that. And it's important that people do, because Gibraltar has kept ticking. To a very large extent, for a long period, people stayed at home, working from home in many cases. And Gibraltar kept ticking. And so people might now have emerged from their homes, gone back to an adjusted form of reality with their masks and with social distancing, and perhaps it's not perfect, and of course it's not perfect, because we've lost some of our freedoms and the traditional way that we live our lives. And people might think in those circumstances that subjects who have been losing some of their freedoms, their ability to go out at night and to perhaps hug and kiss, we are back to normal. But people need to understand that what we did was we bought the broker stability. We bought its stability. And there needs to be a reality check that we can't be buying that stability at that rate for years to come. The economy has to go back to normal. We need to spend the revenue off. We need to grow income. And those are all powerful reasons. We need to attract trade. We need to foster opportunities for our business community domestically. We need to get out there again. Government needs to get out there again to attract business internationally in a vigorous way, in a new environment. And I know that that's difficult, and I know that we still have so many reports anecdotally, of course, that we have to work in the private sector and have dealings with people outside. You'll get those stories of how the business community in other countries has a whole work of experiences. And I know that things are not back to normal, and they may not ever be back to the normality that we knew before COVID, the same new environment. But within the new environment, you can still see and see business opportunities. It's important for us to do so, because what we cannot afford to spend as a reality check in this community is to think that we can button down hatches, whether there's a deal on the Brexit or not, we can button down hatches and basically buy ourselves the ability for years to come without returning to some economic analysis. And those are what, that is why there are good reasons why, subject to a public health crisis, then we need to try to avoid a second lockdown. And I say that because the number of active cases now is no difference to when we had the lockdown. But of course, the difference, and that's what people need to understand, is cases go up to a level that they were 3 or 4 weeks ago, or cases go up a bit more, whether it's 80 or 100 or maybe even 200 cases. What we cannot do is behave as what we were, how we were behaving in March, because in March, the reason why we were behaving the way we were is because, first of all, we did not have the experience to do it. Secondly, we did not have the fallback position in the health service. Having now adjusted, and having now had that experience, having now ensured that we have the infrastructure, both in human terms and in terms of physical infrastructure in the health service, we need to try to avoid the economic strain that came with the lockdown and make sure that we get back to as much economic normality as is possible. So, I know my honourable friend, Mr. Clinton, may be asking a bit more detail on the budget. So that, in summary, is why we will support this budget. I want to also, on this measure, I also want to explain, as the honourable member knows, because we've spoken privately about it before, and indeed I said it in this house when we came here for the March 2020 6-month extension of the budget, that in supporting this budget, we do not abandon our traditional stance on public finances, transparency, and the reasons that we have explained on this side of the house before I came back into this house at the last election, the reasons we have been voting against the budget for reasons of transparency and so on that my predecessors in leadership have explained. We will support this measure because we have had, in the discussions that we did go back to March and indeed May, which I reflected in discussions in the past, we have had a level of assurances that our comments have been taken on board and transparency as to the figures and the running totals and the effect on the economy that we wanted to have. And we welcome those assurances when they were given, and I can confirm to the House that the figures that the Chief Minister and I agreed to the opposition would be given confidentially in his letter, the 14th of May, to me, has been given. And it is for that reason as well that we can lend our support to this continued extension, because in assurance that for the next period of few months, until this staggered period ends, we will continue to receive that information, and until the COVID fund exists and is wound up, we will continue also to obtain that information, because these were extraordinary times that needed extraordinary measures and extraordinary unprecedented cooperation on financial and public health matters between the government and the opposition, because we wanted to get this community that we love through this crisis. We took that position in the public interest in March, and indeed it was entirely justified. People can judge the government and the opposition going forward on a number of things. by our hoping to call. If we continue to manage this crisis in the way that we have been managed so far, it may be that we can all emerge from whenever the group of the world emerges from this issue, having said Gibraltar was spared from the worst effects of COVID, and if that is the case, we will all be happier, and our families will all be happier for it. We also do not, of course, abandon the points that we have made about the arrival point in the strain, the economic strain that might be compounded by what we call the arrival point. In other words, shorthand for our criticism, our traditional criticism, that the state of public finances were such that this additional strain is not helped by the fact of how public finances were when we arrived at this point. I make that point simply to flag it. It is not intended to start a cognitive debate today, and so that you can assume it will be to. But I won't go on about that issue. That is for another day. What the figures do show, as I said before, is the need to quickly restart and boost the economy. And indeed, from the figures that we have seen, there are some signs of recovery, although there are also some signs of glitches. And a situation that can best be explained as two steps forward, one step back in some areas, where we will need a bit more detail from the government, either privately or by questions in the South. The objective for all of us must be to stop operating at this basis of a running loss of our economy. Clearly, we are all invested in Gibraltar. We are all invested in making sure that Gibraltar returns to a state where the running day-to-day expenses are not as they are today, where we are, as the chief minister says, spending more than we are earning. We want to make sure we go back to earning more than we spend, and then we can have a debate about the prudence of that spending. We are certainly going to have a debate about prudence if we continue spending more than we are earning. What we need to do, and I think the underlying message from us on this side of our house, is that we entirely are conscious of the fact there needs to be a reality check that Gibraltar cannot continue spending at this level, that we bought that stability, that it was in the interest of Gibraltar, and we had our support to buy that stability because it was necessary to do so, but that as we go forward, we need to adjust to normality, avoid a second lockdown as much as possible, and make sure that we return to the day that Gibraltar earns more than it spends.
The Honourable Marlene Hassan Naon.
Mr. Speaker, as you all know, these are very difficult times for everybody. Difficult for those in positions of responsibility, but also difficult for those of us tasked with scrutinizing the decisions made to safeguard our community. I understand, as do most Gibraltarians, that many decisions have been difficult. I understand also that the members of this government are human, and therefore they make mistakes like the rest of us. It is in this spirit that I bring my honest critique here today, Mr. Speaker, understanding my obligation, but also understanding the reality that these times require generosity and the avoidance of partisan point scoring. When I do criticize, Mr. Speaker, I won't be chastising the government for their mistakes, but for any opportunities wasted. I would also like to say a thing or two about something that has become very important in the past years, on which the Chief Minister himself addressed profusely in his National Day speech. We are losing the trust of more and more members of the electorate, and this, let's call it skepticism, is only getting worse. In these complicated times, it is not only policy that is important. It is not just the substance that matters, but also the style. When the government communicates erratically, issuing contradictory statements in a tone that comes across as arrogant or authoritarian, even the best designed policies are destined to fail. We need to get people on board with government policies so that they will exercise their individual responsibility in the way that society needs them to, Mr. Speaker. And unfortunately, this government has missed the mark quite often in this respect. Let me start by referring to this budget extension and the economic measures implemented throughout this pandemic. I understand that circumstances call for an extension of the budget and that the unpredictable nature of events requires flexibility and swift action. In terms of missed opportunities I referred to, Mr. Speaker, I believe we should be applying more strategic thinking in our spending plan, as the Leader of the Opposition also said, particularly when we forcefully intervene in the economy in the way we have for the last few months. Yes, we have protected our businesses. Yes, we have protected employment. Yes, we have extended a hand of solidarity and support to our cross-border workers. We have poured a substantial amount of public money into putting certain sectors of our economy in life support. And it was the right thing to do to salvage certain sectors, which will rapidly bounce back once the COVID rolls are over. However, Mr. Speaker, could we not have invested more strategically in those sectors, able to provide a sustainable and long-term future for our economy? Could we not have provided help to those trading industries so they may change and adapt in order to future-proof our economy? The debate on the future of employment, Mr. Speaker, was one that we started having way before the start of this pandemic. It has been well known by everybody in this chamber and beyond that there are certain sectors that are greatly threatened by the changes in technology, employment, and consumer habits. Then there's the issue of environmental sustainability, something that our economy is seriously lagging behind on, even by our own standards and objectives. We should have taken this into account when intervening in our economy, investing with the vision and the foresight at that very moment, and funding sustainable and viable industries and providing extra incentives for investments in these fields. This has largely been a missed opportunity, but it is never too late to change course. As you see that in connection with Brexit, do we know yet what will be the Brexit impact on the core sectors of our economy? Does this budget take the effects of a potential no-deal Brexit into account, given that the budget now runs to March 2021 beyond the final stage of Brexit? Mr. Speaker, on the COVID management, regarding the border's management of the coronavirus pandemic, I believe our track record so far has lights and shadows, regardless of the fact that we have not suffered any deaths in our community. This fact, as happy as it is, that our success so far in beating a surge in cases has largely been the consequence of a very benevolent manifestation of the virus in our territory, producing an overwhelming majority of very mild cases. I would like to make clear that this assertion does not intend to undermine the sterling job of our medical professionals throughout the pandemic, to which we are all greatly indebted. But the fact remains, however, Mr. Speaker, that the case count in Gibraltar is not better than other territories in our vicinity. It is at roughly 1,000 cases per 100,000 inhabitants, which stands among the highest in the world. This detail, which would appear to be alarming at first glance, is in fact testament to what has probably been the greatest success of this administration in the management of the pandemic: a prolific, robust, and efficient testing and contact tracing operation, which is managing to keep the numbers in check and is detecting many asymptomatic cases before they turn into larger outbreaks. So on this front, I sincerely congratulate all those involved in making this happen, and I wish them the best of luck going forward, because it will also be our luck, Mr. Speaker. As for the shadows, in the context of the shadows and lights, I believe these are mostly in the preventative measures taken by this administration. The lack of leadership to an extent and determination with which these measures have been applied and imposed, and the way both government and public health authorities have communicated them to the general public. We should not be relying on cases to be mild. I share the Chief Minister's objective of achieving a clean sheet of deaths in Gibraltar, and in order to make that happen, we need to put an end to the mixed messaging. foundation on that. We need more masks used in public, in closed spaces, and public spaces, Mr. Speaker. And MPs should always be leading by example on this. We need better control measures in schools. We need to make sure norms regarding gatherings are strictly enforced. We need firm leadership and clear messaging to steer us through what is left of this crisis. Mr. Speaker, when looking at the green paper, this crisis does raise many more questions than answers. By way of this extension, another period goes past where we cannot scrutinize government revenue to the extent that we usually do. It is unclear how much of this budget will be covered by way of borrowing in the end. All of us here understand that all nations over the world have had to take on record amounts of debt due to the virus and the economic measures needed. After the banking crisis of 2008, where big players like the US Federal Reserve and the Bank of England had to bail out the too big to fail banks with a huge bailout, government spending obviously increased. In 2010, the stock was returned and the UK government attempted to pay back debt, causing banks to enforce soft cuts in public spending and tax cuts. As he told the community in June of that year, called for the strategy would become growth-friendly fiscal consolidation. This did not work, Mr. Speaker. According to the ONS in 2010, the debt was totaled at £1.194 billion. Then in 2018, before the pandemic, it totaled at £1.838 billion. So since the Chief Minister confirmed in a viewpoint on the 15th of May this year, thankfully, that austerity is not on the cards, how exactly does the government plan to invest efficiently into a green economic recovery without wastage so that we can lower our debt as a percentage of GDP in the long term and keep good credit rating? And Mr. Speaker, with reference to the BEAT measures, what's the Chief Minister saying that we are ready for an eventuality where businesses might require support beyond next summer? Because I think many businesses, feeling the uncertainty of the COVID crisis, would like to know more. Could we get clarity on why a sum of $110,850,000 is required to fund expenditure from the Improvement and Development Fund? Have we identified the cost per case associated with the COVID response? Mr. Speaker, there appears to be recurring expenditure identified in Part 1, Economic Development, that continues to grow despite the clear downturn in the economy. Further clarity would be appreciated on why, for example, immigration and civil status is costing us $5 million, economic development, $8.6 million. It appears as though there has not been a reduction to departments for the most part, yet we remain unable to have a budget prepared. And the Chief Minister explained the reason for the failure in the delivery of this constitutional requirement. Mr. Speaker, and on borrowing, can government offer specifics of the financial firepower that the Chief Minister has just talked about and that it says it has? Because people are thirsty for clarity at a time when there's so much insecurity over our public finances, and they ask themselves, and they ask us, is the government running out of money? How much is left? How much against the wall are we? Mr. Speaker, in the face of increased spending despite the pandemic, what cost containment program has the government deployed in other areas? Other areas? Meaning, where have we saved the money and how much? What impact will there be on capital projects, given that projects were put on hold in light of the pandemic? Because, Mr. Speaker, I do hope that in the last 2 quarters, the government has come up with an estimate of the cost of COVID holistically to the Gibraltar economy. The loss of production, projects that are delayed or pulled, there is a cost to this, Mr. Speaker. Delaying projects does not just save money, but it loses off economic activity. Mr. Speaker, with reference to Appendix B, page 171, what does exactly the £46 million relate to in relation to the Gibraltar Development Corporation? And regarding the COVID fund, what measures were introduced to prevent misallocation and at a time when people and businesses are struggling to make ends meet, with hundreds of millions are being allocated by government, can this amount be returned or assigned and not held indefinitely? the use of some other force potentially. Speaker, the majority of heads have increased by 33.33%. What drives an essentially 33.33% increase across the board? Why is there even increases in certain heads, Mr. Speaker? In finance, there are effectively two types of expenditure items: fixed costs and variable costs. As the name suggests, the fixed cost is fixed. In your household, you have certain monthly costs, which is fixed: rent, mobile phone, television license. No matter if you use it or not, you pay for it. Then there are the variable costs, such as the water and electricity, which is dependent on the use for that particular month. So there might well be fixed costs for the head, but only there would be a reduction in the variable cost. So what drives the 33% increase then? In light of the reality that we haven't had the annual exhaustive and traditional budget that we can scrutinize with a fine tooth comb, I hope and expect that government instead organize and have on the opposition queries over this budget. Because being read of a true budget process during these serious times will always call for more accountability and not less. I take this opportunity to thank once again and echo the Chief Minister's expression of gratitude to our people, our essential services, their exemplary outpouring of determination, commitment, hard work to help and put themselves out for the people of our community in these very difficult moments. Thank you.
The Honourable Roy Clinton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, first of all, I will echo the sentiments of the leader of the opposition and identify my opening remarks and also specifically with reservation as to our historical position on the budget process. But of course, in terms of this particular appropriation bill, as we will, as the leader of the opposition indicated, be supporting it in the statement. To put my intervention, I'd like to delve a little bit deeper into the numbers. And what I propose to do, Mr. Speaker, is go perhaps unusually, starting with the specific and then moving to the general. And, Mr. Speaker, before I do that, I have to record my thanks to the Chief Minister and to the Financial Secretary for perhaps the unprecedented and the very productive and constructive interactions we have had in dealing with the financial consequences of the COVID crisis. And to think of anywhere I want to commence my intervention, and that is the COVID crisis and the numbers that have been required in terms of financing to meet the COVID crisis cost. Speaker, when we met in March, we were facing an emergency situation, and quite rightly, we've all described it as an emergency budget. What we are meeting today to discuss is the appropriation bill, hopefully kicking forward another 6 months, so that, as Chief Minister correctly pointed out, we'll be looking effectively at a budget for a 2-year period. And in that respect, Mr. Speaker, there are, of course, many different ways we can talk about the year. We could have chosen to keep to a September year end, and from here on thereafter, September would be our new year end. But then, as the Chief Minister correctly pointed out, it would make comparison difficult. Here is my argument: well, it doesn't really matter, you could always keep September for the future. However, I think it's perhaps quite an expediency that we agree that we should go back to our old March year end, and therefore in years to come it would be a fairly easy matter for somebody to divide by two. I think, speaking in that respect, I think moving the year end forward to March will have our support. The general numbers, Mr. Speaker, in the appropriation bill, the most important number that I would want people to focus on is the 150 million projected contribution to the COVID response fund. Well, Speaker, this $150 million, as the Chief Minister pointed out, is actually funded by the borrowing which the government has entered into with the facilities obtained from the World International Bank, which has been confirmed today, is now fully drawn down. So that is the way in which we are, as a community, funding what will be this exceptional expenditure. It's important that we put this into context in the sense where last year's surplus, which is the highest ever, was about £18.8 million. And even on the projections for 2019-20 regional budget book that we had last year, the surplus would have been a conservative £20 million, but even then, the balance for the Pathology Fund would have been £135 million in total. So, if you figure £150 million is way above anything that we could have met out of recurrent revenue or reserves, although we do have some reserves in things that we could still draw upon. So, if you figure when we look at the spending on this money, certainly. From the opposition point of view, I do recognize that the government volunteered the idea of having the COVID response fund in which to act as a bucket, as it were, to collect all the related information financially that this crisis is costing us. And the government also took on board our suggestion that this should be published quarterly, so that the community can see for itself what is being spent and how. And I think it is critical that as soon as the numbers are presented today, if they even get in the press, will publish that statement in full, because of course not everybody will have access to the Gazette. I think it's particularly important that they see how this fund is operated. There have been some unkind comments on social media suggesting that, for example, the donations from the GHA have gone astray, but you will see that it is accounted for in the COVID response fund. And what you will see is the COVID response fund was funded from the consolidated fund. It received all the money it spent from the consolidated fund. The consolidated fund in turn receive this money from borrowing. So basically, you borrow a pound, and then that pound is given into the COVID response fund. Well, if you think it's important for people to understand that the COVID response fund, as far as I'm aware, and today I can't see how it will happen, will never recover this money. This money is gone. It's spent or used in effectively reimbursing the government for lost revenue. When you look at this statement when it's published, you'll see the state from the consolidated fund, and then you'll see a line that says contributions to revenue, this is figure. And in that, the Chief Minister has already identified that there is foregone revenue of £59 million. As Speaker, £59 million, the Honourable Farber has already pointed out that it costs about £55 million just to run the water for 1 month. You will see that the government will have suffered financially in terms of its revenue, and they have to be made up from somewhere. And of course, that is where the borrowing comes in. And then the second line, which will be seen in this statement, will be the payment. Now, these are actual payments that will be made by various entities in government, obviously the GOK and the BEAT payments. And the way that will work, and it has capital payments as well, but the way it works, and this has already been agreed with government, so that it makes it pretty clear to anybody reading the estimates book that will be introduced in the future, is that rather than net off any assistance from the COVID fund against exceptional costs to say GHA, what will happen is there will be a separate line within the GHA expenditure to be showing the contribution to the COVID fund. So the full expense will be in the GHA, but there will be a contribution from the COVID fund in respect of exceptional COVID expenditure. And so in that way, in this COVID response fund, there will be one place, one go-to place, where everybody wants to know what the impact of COVID has been, whether it's on the government recurrent revenue or exceptional expenditure incurred by government departments and capital expenditure. You will find this in this statement in the COVID fund. And the idea is that this is the first one that will be public. The idea is that this will then be updated and published on a quarterly basis going forward, so that there is full and total transparency as to what is going on with the COVID response fund. As the Chief Minister pointed out, there is a balance showing at the end of June of 1.7 million, which for 1.8 million, which actually equates to the donations received by the JJ and the supported refund. And that money, as the Chief Minister pointed out, has yet to be allocated in terms of use. And don't forget, I think it is a testament to our ability to cooperate in exceptional circumstances that we have been able to agree on this type of presentation and format. I thank, again, the Chief Minister and Council Secretary for actually taking on board our suggestions and being able to agree on format. And I think it's very important that the community looks at this statement and fully understands what the impact of COVID is. And from a financial point of view. And this statement, of course, is important to understand, only goes up to the 30th of June. So, the preparation bill will go up to the 1st of March. So, if here we are saying the expense or there has been a cost of COVID of 81 million, you can expect that the government is effectively anticipating either further costs to be incurred by the end of the year or further contributions to revenue being necessary. So, of course, as the Chief Minister points out, this is not an estimate, and the outcome may be something very different. So, first, Mr. Speaker, in terms of the appropriation bill, the important number to me is the 150 million going from the consolidated fund to the COVID-19 response fund. I think it is that is the highlight number that people should focus on. It will, I think, focus keep in mind in terms of what this is costing us and how we are actually funding it. Is this funding of this response fund is effectively coming at the moment from borrowing. And it will be borrowing that we will, as a community, eventually have to repay. So, speaking of that, that would be my specific contribution on the COVID fund. As I say, I would encourage ladies and gentlemen request to publish it in full, so that the public will see the details. So, moving on to the budget numbers themselves, I must confess I was a bit mystified at the Honourable Lady's intervention to talk about an increase of 33%. I'm looking at it now, and I can just see that we may be comparing to the last budget. So I'm happy to give away that the way she calculated it. If not, what I can tell the House, Mr. Speaker, is that, certainly from the schedule that the financial topic has provided me with, all the heads are effectively a duplication, i.e., the Chief Minister multiplied by two, of the original budget book that was presented for 2019-20. So, just each number multiplied by two, plus or minus any rounding, except four, and at the end of the season has properly identified them, the head for education, health, and the elderly residential services sector. So that basis that the House can be assured mentioned that the numbers are really a duplication by two acceptable heads of the book that was presented last year. And speaking of the heads, which are different, i.e. two plus a bit, and education in the double plus 12 and a half million, according to the schedule. I would be, I'm not going to ask many questions if you think that perhaps it would be can provide some comfort to students in that really I'm getting feedback that there are difficulties in grant payments. Some people are being told there is no money. I mean, this is frequently shows there is money in that we are working on it today. I think it will obviously provide the comfort and reassurance to those students that they need not worry about their grant payments. I don't think perhaps about those that may be experiencing some difficulty on the clawback as to how perhaps there may be extra devices in cases where there may be some disagreements. And then the money is obviously there to speak in the appropriate. The second number I look at is the DHA number, which apart from multiplying by two, has an extra 41 million on top. And particularly the big mention is mainly through COVID, although I must note that as of June, there was 8 million, hopefully COVID expenditure related to 9 million, as of June. And is that 40 million really the expected total expenditure of GHA and COVID, or is there something else in there that the House should be aware of? So, just to mean the numbers themselves, as I said, Mr. Speaker, they are merely a doubling up of the estimate book, which was debated last year, apart from those heads. And Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister mentioned that we had drawn down fully the 150 million. I'd be grateful, and I do know, I'm conscious of this, I have a question in the order paper, so I won't repeat those questions, but I would ask if he has a position as of today of what the government's next step position is. I'd be grateful in the government, I understand that it's probably a number he doesn't have to hand, and I'll be happy to do that for questions on that. If he has, it'd be great. So, there's not much more to be said about the numbers, Mr. Speaker. I mean, they are what they are. Invariably, and in fact, as the former House has said, you know, our net debt is going to be invariably the highest ever because we have to meet the cost of this crisis. And there's no other way of doing it. And I think in this House we all agree that we have to act and in terms of how we should go about protecting the community, this is the best way of doing it. So that's about the numbers, Mr. Speaker. And I just want to talk briefly about the measures that the Chief Minister has mentioned. Certainly, as we move into the next 3 to 6 months, that deal with budget covers, we are going to be facing some severe economic challenges, not just because of COVID, but also because of Brexit. And certainly, anything that the government can do to help the economy in general, and specifically through sales, I'm sure will be welcomed by the business community. The extension of Beach 3.0, or the introduction of 3.0, I will know that to welcome. As to whether that will be enough, again, I leave that for sales to discuss with the government. But certainly, the measures will be very welcome. And today we have, as the Lady of Britain indicated, given the Cuban fund attitude to continue in terms of emergency powers up to the end of the year if further measures are being necessary, Mr. Speaker. I think, Speaker, in summary, all I would say is, again, you know, we need the lifeline of 150 million to see us through the last 6 months. The coming 6 months are certainly going to be challenging. The government will have to make some difficult decisions, no doubt. But it is important that the message goes out in this place that although we have managed to plug the gap in the last 6 months, it is not a sustainable way of running our economy, and that our people need to understand, in looking at the COVID response fund, what the cost of meeting this crisis has been. And I think this House will do what we must to protect our people and our economy, but there is, of course, a financial limit to what is physically possible in an economy of the size of ours. Now, as much as I obviously wish our economy all the health and wealth in the future, we need to be realistic as a community going forward and cut our food according to our clock. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Does any other honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? Or ask the Minister to us?
I think there is a tendency for members to speak not just in the House but as well outside the House to interchange references to the public finances and the economy as they do in the country. They are two totally separate and different things. And I am responsible for the development of the and the implementation of the plan that we produced during the election and it's reflected in the manifesto, which is designed to counteract the negative effect of a hard Brexit with the United Kingdom and that hard Brexit affecting us. Therefore, there is nothing in the National Economic Plan that has been put there to deal with the effect of a pandemic. Of course, the effect of a pandemic is a health issue. And therefore, when we're talking about the effect of the pandemic, it's not so much the cost of dealing with restoring the health of the people who get ill, or doing things in the health service. The real issue that has, in effect, put the global economy into recession has been protecting people from getting infected by locking down the economy. The result of that is that almost every country in the Western world is now in a situation of running deficits on recurrent expenditure. And we are, as we get to say, in that situation, which is something that is anathema to the GSLP, and an anathema by definition to the government that is there to implement the GSLP policy. The golden rule is you may borrow to build a school, but you don't borrow to pay the school teacher, because if you borrow to pay the school teacher, you end up borrowing to pay the interest on the pay of the school teacher. And after that, it's a paper. That is not where we want to be, and it's not where we want to go. But we need to understand that the background of the global economy limits the potential of our economy, whatever we do. That is to say, it's not in our gift to do things that are not possible. It's not in our gift to make cruise liners stop here if there are no cruise liners departing from the port of origin. And nothing that we do can change that. The National Economic Plan was not based on the premise that there will not be cruise liners, or that there will not be people going to the upper hall, or that there will not be coaches, or that there will not be flights. None of that is something that the National Economic Plan is designed to counteract, because none of that would have had
Mr. Conley to have happened is all that we had was a Brexit without a deal that created a new relationship and therefore one which affected supply. But of course, the economic plan was designed to deal with supply. This is why one of the important things in the National Economic Plan is the approach that requires that we don't see our economy growing by ever-increasing labor input. The National Economic Plan specifically projects an estimated working population of 32,000 for October 2019, which is Kingdom Hub, and that should not grow beyond that level, and that the growth of the economy beyond that level should be based not on employing more people, not in doubling the input in order to double the output, because that creates on a per capita basis no change, but on being able to produce more with the same resources. That is what efficiency means. It means that you are using your human resources and your capital and your assets more efficiently. And it is the only way that we can generate growth in the future. There is no alternative to that. And in the process of greater efficiency, we must also have as an objective making the voter as self-sufficient as possible. The less we depend on having to have fluidity, the safer we are in being able to deliver results. Because fluidity is not in our hands. There are things that we cannot deliver which require other people to behave in a certain way which we have no control over. So, as far as the economy is concerned, the economy is on track to deliver the National Economic Plan an increase by 15%. But it will not be by 15% of the size of the economy that was there when the pandemic started, because that is no longer there. We're going to eventually find out just how much damage there has been in the national output, but we don't know what that is today. Honorable member opposite has asked me, why can't we have more recent and more up-to-date figures? Well, because, as I told him, the way that we calculate it and the way we've always calculated it and the way we think it's the most reliable way, where we have both different sources of information which don't coincide, is by looking at the report that is produced in October on the basis of showing what the earnings of the entire working population of Gibraltar was. Well, this was about 880 million pounds when we last calculated it, which was in October 2018. And it's likely to be higher in October 2019, but it may well be lower next month. So that is the background to the economic situation. The nature of the elements in the National Economic Plan, in terms of their effect on the government finances, on the public finances, is that it will not have a significant impact on increasing government revenue, but it will have an impact on reducing increases in government spending. And the element of that is the involvement of investment from the private sector and the delivery of things by the private sector. And therefore, the things that are there for a reason. And the reason is that the level of efficiency is going to be delivered not just by looking at how we are doing things in the government, where there is still, a return to be made on the money we are putting into the government, which has not yet materialized, but which hopefully will materialize at some stage, I hope, but also to make better use of the resources in the private sector. But the reality is that the Honourable Member mentioned the figure that I said in the past that was not sustainable, which was the annual growth that we had in the cost of delivering services. Well, that, as we all know, Mr. Speaker, amounted to 210 million over a 7-year period, an annual increase of 30 million per annum. And I have said on a number of occasions, not to discuss with some people, that we could not carry on growing the spending by 30 million every year because we could not guarantee that our revenue will grow by 30 million every year. We are now at that point. We now know that they will not grow. In fact, I do not believe we shall see the level that we had in 1819 of 706 million pounds. I don't think we're going to see that for many, many years to come. That kind of level of. And this is not if everything goes wrong, that is, if nothing goes right to have a sustainable economic growth when other people are interested, and effective control over unnecessary spending, and even in that circumstance, I think the £706 million that we saw, which is, I think, the highest we have today, is not going to be there. I would say it will not be there before the election. That's my idea. So, the message that I said that we need to be realistic, the realism that is required is that the state in which we are going to finish after this pandemic is over, whenever that may be, is going to be one where the existing level of expenditure will then be not covered by the then existing level of revenue. It is difficult to see areas where we could raise revenue from our own people in the kind of numbers that we're talking about. Because it is obvious that there is and many people may think, well, look, we could raise taxation on companies or what kind of thing. Well, the reality is that we've got an economy where a big chunk of the activity that brings revenue to the government is an activity which doesn't have to be here. It has to be here because we are providing a competitive environment. We haven't got a choice because it is not a question that there are captive customers. They are not captive customers. So if you increase the cost of being in the voter, they simply will not stay because there is no reason for them to stay. And in a situation where there is a global recession, other people may be looking to reduce their cost to try and take businesses away from us. This is going to be a very tough global market. And a global market where not just in Gibraltar, but in many other places, we may have to come up with having to face the reality that the new normality is not the lifestyle of the normality that existed before the pandemic. And by comparison with the lockdown and the economic slowdown, which has been good for the environment but not for anything else, but at least that is a silver lining in the cloud, which is good for the environment, that world may be one that marks a historic breaking point in what was the previous view of reality, that every year everybody had more of everything and that this would go on forever. It may well be that that is not the case. It may well be that that is not what's going to happen. And we have to be where the planet is, not where we would like to be, as if nothing had intervened.
for my message, certainly as Minister for Economic Development, we will deliver what we set out to deliver in the manifesto, but that may not be enough to be for what wasn't there in 2019 when we held that manifesto. Thank you. Mr. Speaker, the debate has been going now for approximately an hour and a half. That's an unusually short time for a debate on an appropriation bill, and is a demonstration of even the severity of the issues affecting our community that bring us to this debate in this way. I'm very pleased to have had an opportunity to hear from Sir Joe on this issue of the economy, not the public finances in particular, but the economy, which underlies how the public finances receive the revenue that then becomes the finances of the government. I think it is important that people should listen to the wake-up call that Mr. Joe is setting of how he envisages that the economy is going to be performing in future months and in future years, where the economy was and where it's likely to be, and what the consequences on the public finances are. Because, Mr. Speaker, it's fundamentally important that people, when they return to normality, and when we return to budgetary normality, we do so in the context of the new economic reality that we'll be facing, not just us, but the planet. And the words of Mr. Joe, in respect of how he sees the development of our economy, are not dissimilar to the things that we heard the Chancellor of the Exchequer say in the United Kingdom of the economic prospects there. The likelihood that it will not be possible to save every job, which the Chancellor has been explicit about, tells us the story of businesses that are going to fail. And businesses that fail mean less revenue for a government, less revenue for a government means less spending power for a government. And I think that has been the theme that many of us in the context of this debate have developed today, best encapsulated in the way that the bill has presented the economic outlook for the performance of the economy. But, Mr. Speaker, isn't it remarkable that we have broken knowingly the golden rule of the GSLP to follow to pay the current expenditure? It is remarkable because we knew we had to do it. We also know we can continue to do it. We also know, Mr. Speaker, that this has to be remarkable in its exceptionality, not remarkable in marking a new reality into which we would fall and from which we would not recover. And that is going to be the way in which we approach how we deal with the consequences and after effects of the pandemic. And that might be, Mr. Speaker, a good place for me to turn to the things that the Leader of the Opposition said in supporting the bill, when he talked about wanting normal practice to return. Normal practice, Mr. Speaker, but we cannot wait to see that on this side of the house, both in terms of not borrowing to pay retirement expenditure, and indeed, Mr. Speaker, in the context of having greater revenue than we have expenditure. And in that context, Mr. Speaker, I can very proudly refer the House to the record that we have of having increased revenue more than had been increased in the past, and having a bigger gap between revenue and expenditure than has been the case in any other administration in our history. And that is something that we want to continue. What is the normality that we want to see return? The normality from which we started, the normality where our revenue was going up, and although our expenditure was going up, it was not going up as much as our revenue, and our revenue was growing by more than our expenditure was growing. That is the normal practice to which we must return. And that is the normal practice which we aim to return to in the context of smaller numbers, because the economy will be smaller, and that is the reality that we have to face. The bigger global general is that we've been spared the worst of the pandemic. And I would add today, I think he then subsequently accepted that proviso also himself. We have been spared the worst of the pandemic today, but the pandemic is coming back, and medical science is not yet able to give us a shield against it.
And the older gentleman in developing his opinion in that respect said that the lockdown took its toll on people, and he referred to mental health issues as well, and that this was not just a financial toll, and he's absolutely right, Mr. Speaker. And I do feel, Mr. Speaker, that there is almost a post-traumatic stress that is being played out in the way that people are reacting to the lockdown and their approach to the period post-lockdown, and some people are reacting in ways that just do not appear to be rational. I totally disagree with one of the ladies when she suggests that some people are not accepting the views as to the messages from the government because of the failure of the government to provide a coherent message. I think the message from the government is unfortunately coherent and not yet able to be different to the one that we have been issuing since March. But people are reacting in different ways to the end of the lockdown, etc. And we have to understand that, we have to accept that, we have to analyse why it happened, we need to be understanding of people's views when they are, and coming back to the first statements I made today, and when the government reacted, when they are respectful, when they are not insulting, when they are in keeping with the rules, not racist, and certainly not anti-Semitic. And some people are even going over the line on those issues, Mr. Speaker, more regularly than one would ever expect. The effect of the lockdown is not just being financial, that's absolutely right. Because some people don't have enough time to speculate in different businesses that I might own in different bars and divorces. Unfortunately, it is not true. These days, the case association wouldn't treat me to a glass of beer if I turned up for a thirsty, given the restrictions that I make. There has to be one of the gentlemen said, no second lockdown will become available. And I had said that myself in the entirety of the speaker. That would be the very, very last resort. We would literally do everything else that we could before we ever again imposed a second lockdown. It is worth just reminding ourselves that our lockdown was more generous than lockdowns anywhere else in the world, that we were always more open, that we would not want the second lockdown by the state that we might get. And the reality check that he was referring to is one that I've referred to in many of my addresses, and the one that Bill referred to, and that the Honourable Distinction referred to. We need, Mr. Speaker, people to understand that this was, and the way that I expressed it, I think, in an earlier debate, a generational changing event, a sanity changing event. And the first thing that the pandemic took was up the economy. This we have to be clear about. But by locking people up, we in effect lock up our businesses. And by locking up our businesses, we lock up our economy. And therefore, we must all agree that there has to be a reality check. And I do hope that the speaker that when the time comes, when we return to normality and we return to parliamentary normality, that we do not balk when it comes to giving effect to that reality check. And that we might be able to be together and not submitting ourselves to auctioneering in respect of what the consequences of that pandemic financially are. And I see the smiles and the smirks. That's where politics always is, Mr. Speaker. And I do hope that we will be able to work together as we have in difficult times to prepare our economy and to prepare our people for better times. Or is it, Mr. Speaker, that if we say that we have to increase a cost, that we have to reduce a benefit, that honourable members will say, no, you mustn't do that? Well, the reality check has to mean something if it is going to be a reality check. And if we agree that there is a need for a reality check, I hope we will be able to agree on the consequences of that reality check when the time comes. The other gentleman is actually right, however, to characterise what we did as having brought Gibraltar stability. That's exactly what we did. That is what we deployed the funding for. That is what ensured that people did not suffer the consequences of the businesses in which they worked being shut down, and that is why they continue to be able to buy the basics and put food on their table. And it's essential, Mr. Speaker, that we realise that that is what we do. And it is equally essential that we realise, and I agree with him and with the idea of the country, that we cannot continue to do that indefinitely, and we can do as little of that as possible going forward because we should be returning our businesses to as close to normality as possible, where that is realistic, because there are, of course, businesses who rely on people coming into the water, and if those people are locked down in their place of residence, they're not going to be able to get on the plane or get in the train or get on a cruise ship to come to the water. And these are all of the things that are in the balance. And so, yes, he's right, Mr. Speaker, and that is this international traditional environment, we must grow our income, we must do all that. But we are already trying to do that. And one of the things that, that I've seen my ministerial colleagues do is start the process of trying to attract new business, which is also using our record on COVID for the purpose of showing that people the ability that there is to do, continue to do business in Gibraltar, and there isn't the ability to do business elsewhere. The continuity is provided through COVID, which makes it attractive. There are new applicants for business in Gibraltar, even now, Mr. Speaker. There are people arriving. There are new proposals for business in Gibraltar, and we are pursuing those very, very rigorously indeed. Because if there is one thing that the Honourable the father of the House would like to see, it is that his prediction as to the growth of the economy would be wrong and it would grow faster. As much as I would certainly hope that we had wasted money on Nightingale, he hopes to get up and say, I was wrong. He was wrong by 30% and not by 15%. Unfortunately, Speaker, he was not often wrong. And the worst thing would be that he might have to get up and say he was wrong and he's gone by 5% instead of 15%. But I'm confident that what he's given us is at least very definitely a flaw. So that work is ongoing, principally led by his ministry, which is the Ministry for Economic Development, but also in respect of all the other ministries where there is the opportunity to bring new business to the border. And the speaker, the fact is that we do know much more about the virus now. So we are able to deal with the virus in a different way. We are able to see not just lockdown as the way to avoid the virus, because as we've discussed before, lockdown is a pretty draconian, pretty historic approach to avoiding a virus. You literally shut the door and get out of its way, because medical science gives you no alternative to protect yourself against it with a vaccination or otherwise. And I think we all agree now, we can be a little more sophisticated, perhaps we've just moved from pre-history to the stone age in the context of our understanding of the virus, and we're not yet in the Enlightenment, but we're a little bit more sophisticated in the way that we'll be able to deal with the virus and avoid the lockdown. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman said that the support that they're giving to the school should not be considered to be them abandoning their traditional arguments and the reasons why they voted against the budget on some occasions. Neither, of course, Mr. Speaker, should they believe that we are abandoning our positions in that respect, that these are more transparent estimates than there have ever been in the history of the Gibraltar, that there is more information about the financial well-being of our economy otherwise than ever before in the context of these estimates and in the context of what is published on our website. Those of our arguments remain valid. But I would say to him, Mr. Speaker, just very gently, that although he has put down his without prejudice marker in the context of explaining his vote today, he might, between now and the next budget debate, want to reflect that this is also a moment in which he might use as a ladder to climb down from a position which sees his party vote against estimates in the ballot. Put him no higher than that, and I invite larger than the Shadow Minister for Public Finance to consider that also in the context of where the debate might be in the next 9 months as we come to a new debate in June or July. And Speaker, he says that, of course, the one thing that will be part of the debate when the time comes will be the question of the arrival point of our economy at COVID. How strong will our public finances when we arrive at COVID? He said that was not for today, but he was putting down a marker, and I would say I accept that was not for today, but I would put down the marker. That we arrive at COVID, able to get through COVID as we have, Mr. Speaker, no better than we would have got to COVID if they had been the ones in administration doing the things that they had said that they would do instead of the things that we would say to do, and indeed to have the Speaker in a better place, because we have been in school, which provides our children with the ability to social distance better than the old school, and we have, the sporting facility has enabled us to do Nightingale. If we haven't spent the money on those, we certainly wouldn't have a Nightingale. So it's not for today, Mr. Speaker, it's not for today, as you said, but we did say something about it, and I would say just that as the picture for how we will be dealing with those arguments for the time coming. So, Mr. Speaker, we want to get back to correcting more on the same. I agree. It's been our position throughout this process that we don't want to forego revenue for a moment longer than we have to, but you will want to agree with me that we want to get back to our levels of collection of revenue, which were higher than they ever were. So, Mr. Speaker, I think there will be, as we move even to a normal parliamentary debate, a large measure of agreement as to objectives, and as ever, the argument will be the argument that we fit on the detail to an extent. That is what we are required to do. I therefore, Mr. Speaker, would say that in the same way as he vehemently said that he thinks we need to get back to higher revenue to get our spending into an amount that is below the revenue, in other words, that our spending is to be lower than our revenue, I would say that we are as vehement in wishing to achieve that, but we want to achieve in the way that we did, which was that the spread between expenditure and revenue was wider in our time than it was in theirs, and they, I hope, will agree that that should be the objective. I think I have to say to the Honourable Lady that as I did when we started the beginning of the session, I defend her right to say the things that she says and to challenge us, but she was completely off the mark today. She gave a speech which was not informed by the things that I said during the course of my intervention. She was replying to me, but she was not replying to me. In other words, she had prepared, obviously, in respect of the bill that she had, but she had taken into consideration none of what I said in respect to that, and she gave an address which I have to say to her very gently and respectfully, I do not believe is the product of anyone who has ever turned their attention to the public finances, because the questions they were asking were as if an accountant who had never dealt with public finances was looking at a public finance book for the first time. And so I'm sorry to say that I found her intervention in respect of the detail very lacking, but I must tell her that she was very gracious in the way that she addressed the way that we have dealt with things until now in the context of COVID, and I sincerely appreciate that, although I do not accept the things that she was saying were irrelevant. I don't believe that it's right to talk about more strategic thinking needs to be done, as if strategic thinking were not being done, that we have to invest in our forward-looking environmental industry, as if we were not trying to do that where it is possible, but actually what we're dealing with is a public health pandemic that we have to address, and we have to address in the guy, we have to invest in the guy who has the clapping on the corner, the guy who's got the stop on the corner, and the guy who's running the restaurant, not just in the person who's got the greatest idea for a potential environmental business going forward, because we have to say the people who are in jobs now, and of course we're looking forward. But it's very easy, Mr. Speaker, to say what it is. It's very easy to say we must be strategic, we must look forward, we must invest in the industries of the future, and that's what we fail to do. Which are the industries of the future that we haven't invested in? Who is the business that you think is integral to that could take that investment? When did they approach us? When did we fail to see them and approach them? These are the things that we need to be looking at in the context of the detail of these numbers. If we're going to say any numbers, we're not going to be very proper. And so, Mr. Speaker, I must say to her that I thought that he was lacking on that. And we are not, by any measure, the worst nation in the world when it comes to COVID. 1,000 per 100,000 being the largest COVID in the world, the COVID per capita in the world. Nonsense, Mr. Speaker. There are barriers in Madrid that are reporting 1,400,000 today. Today. So he was wrong on that, Mr. Speaker. So I'm sorry to say that I entirely disagree with it, that our record on COVID is more lights than shadows, but that there are many shadows. Look, everywhere in the world, we've got to learn from how we've dealt with this pandemic, and we would have done things right, and we would have done things wrong. president. I think few places in the world can pride themselves in the way that their public sector has dealt with COVID and the way that it has, and I will defend that vigorously against the suggestion that we have not. Indeed, the idea that there has been a lack of leadership in Cordova, and I don't claim that leadership for myself, but in the public service, in the GHO, in public health Cordova, that the idea that there's been a lack of leadership, leading to the state of the lady, come on. Come on. It's one thing to say, I reckon that I'd be a better leader than you. It's quite another to say that in the context of the past 6 months, the government has been lacking in leadership. Look, this is bigger. It is totally contrary to what our worst critics say about us. Our worst critics say that we have been dictatorial in the approach that we have taken. So that's a lot of leadership. We have dictatorial. It is direct command leadership, Mr. Speaker. Right? Our worst critics accuse us of having given too much leadership. And Mr. Speaker, again, I don't claim it for myself because I am not the doctor who is running the strategy on COVID. I'm the politician who is there with this parliament and with my team to try and manage all of the parts of this that come together, and sometimes I have to give a speech to explain it. But to say that there is a lack of leadership in this context is, in my view, just wrong. And to use the example of masks is particularly wrong in my view, Mr. Speaker. So there is a lot that is developing in the context of the understanding of the virus. Masks is one of the issues that changes, and it's not a lack of leadership to follow the science of those things. Because, Mr. Speaker, this is one of the ways you came to say. You should have been wearing masks before the World Health Organization recommended it. Well, then, you think of what use of science and doctors and medicine. So, we just take a view of what we think as lay people works, and is that leadership? Look, the figure that if we work in the past, and one might have thought that if it's a virus, one of the best ways to get it out of us, especially to affect the lungs, is to put a leak on the chest. They tried that 400 years ago, and it didn't quite work. So the other lady would forgive me. She would forgive me for leaving this community only in the direction of the advice that we have from the doctors who are the ones who advise us on this, whether it's public health worker, whether it's the DHA, who will follow that advice. And we think that the best test of leadership is to understand who it is that you should be taking some advice from. And so, Mr. Speaker, the idea that we need firmer leadership than dictatorship, which is a race against that. But that we need clearer messaging, I think, with respect to the other way, is completely wrong. And it was wrong to say, in our analysis, that it's not derived from the fact that the address is the address of somebody who doesn't understand public finances, and he's been here for long enough to understand it. But we need to keep our credit rating. Because we don't have a credit rating. We cannot keep that which we do not have. Successive administrations under successive chief ministers, all of them, have not sought a credit rating for Gibraltar. For a simple reason. The minute you seek a credit rating, you put yourself in the hands of the credit rating agency, and then the ratings can go up and down depending on their subjective assessment of what you're doing, or indeed their subjective assessment of something that somebody else is doing and how it might affect you. So that part of your speech, as you said, you need to analyze what you're doing, or to ensure that we keep our credit rating, is a demonstration of the fact that the address was prepared without an understanding of the public finances of the debate and the consequences thereof for the rest of the system. So, when you ask about what the 33% was, you know, you've got 50% or 150%, what's the 33%? It's very simple, Mr. Speaker. What I've explained today, and therefore that's why I'm thinking you wasn't replying to what I've explained today, is that we're going from 150% increase, which is what we did in the first 6 months, to 200% increase. You take 100, you add 50, that's a 50% increase. You take that 150 up to 200, that's a 33% increase. That should have been understood even by the accountant who didn't understand public finances. So, Mr. Speaker, there is clarity in the figures. Just in the somewhere because there's no information on what the money is spent in the GDP. Of course there is. Because this green bill, as I've explained, what happened, and everybody can understand, this green bill goes back into the schedule which is the book, the estimate book, which has a whole section on the Gibraltar Development Corporation, which explains the breakdown of the 46 million qua the first 100%, which is then increased by 50%, and is now increased by another 50%. So the total amount spent on the Gibraltar Development Corporation, which is the 46 million times 4, is explained as to the 46 million times 2 in the book, and double it. That's why we're saying this is what makes sense. So again, Mr. Speaker, a complete failure to understand how the public finances are going to work in this is very important as an operation of the Gibraltar Development Corporation. But Mr. Speaker, when he asked me, that are we running out of money? Of course we're not running out of money. That's not how these things work. But we have explained already the need for a reality check, the limits of the public finances of the growth of the smaller finance, and why the evolution of the government has worked together on this. And there isn't, therefore, a failure of a constitutional requirement. The other thing is that we just explain your failure of the constitutional requirement. The whole process in March and now is about ensuring that there isn't a failure of the constitutional requirement. Because the constitutional requirement refers to the financial year but doesn't give the date of the end of the financial year. So what we did in the first statute was push the end of the financial year to the end of September, and what we're doing now in the second amending statute is to push the financial year back to the 31st of March. Therefore, there's no failure of the constitutional statute. Of the constitutional obligation. The statute fixes that, because the parliament fixes that. We could not, actually, in the first statute, because we were doing it before the 31st of March, say that the date of the financial year end will be the 31st of March, because you can't put a year into that date. And therefore, you have to have a date that went beyond the 31st of March, and then clear it after the 31st of March. We could have come here on the 1st of April with this second amendment bill and said, now we're going to go to the 31st of March again, and we would have been able to deal with it. So the only reason we can say, we do this debate, I explained it in the first amending statute, in the Appropriation Bill 2020, which is the first amendment of the Appropriation Act 2019. This is the amendment number 2 bill, and although she hadn't heard my speech and therefore responded without, as if she hadn't heard my speech, she had to heard my first speech that went in detail through the changes which we were making and why that was necessary in order to deal with the constitutional point. I went back to speak and took the House to 1971 to explain how we were doing it. So I do not accept that you could have failed to understand that if you had heard what I understood, what I had said is not. So, Mr. Speaker, I'm very not to have been able to be more generous in the approach, but perhaps it's a good opportunity to reflect that we can be vehemently opposing each other in the context of this parliamentary debate, just as we said at the beginning, without then stepping the line being or passionately defending our right to vehemently be opposing. The Honourable Mr. Clinton started also with the reference to their historical position, which of course I fully understand, although I don't agree. But I do want him to just reflect on whether or not there might be merit in thinking about voting in a different way when we present a different budget bill. And I'm heartened by him raising his eyebrow and turning his head to one side, because when I was inviting the leaders of Britain to do that, they were both shaking their heads, and I'm heartened that you guys shifted them from shake to eyebrow raise in the space of moment. There's nothing else you can do because they haven't yet seen the vote, and they might, when they see the vote, decide that they want to support it. It would be too soon judging the extreme, the presentation of the estimates, to say that they will not accept it, and we've been working very closely together in the past few months. You never know. The ability to work together may continue. Yeah. We should take the view perhaps that the virus has been the vaccine to the inability to work together. There's nothing else. English is trying to feel working together more. Someone that's keeping to the social distance these days, and they're trying to worry that they might infect each other with the sort of venom that I've seen go from one to the other rather than virus. The Honourable Mr. Clinton said, look, in the end what we're doing is we're just kicking this forward 6 months and you can then divide by two when you do the analysis. And as he knows, and he then did the work himself, it multiply by two and add COVID to do the work out with us. So when you undo it, you've got to divide by two, but also take out that element of COVID, which you then explained in his intervention. And I think that's just an important way of, in shorthand, understanding where we are today. And he put great score by the 150 million that we spoke to. As he knows, that is an estimate. We do hope that that's going to be more or less where we are. We are there at the end of September. Let's see what the cost is going forward. But as I said in my intervention, the cost of COVID has started to go down a little. We've got a lot of resources, different ways of dealing with it. I feel that hope that that does not increase, but that is still an estimate. And the other gentleman that referred to our surfaces, he's not been as generous about our surfaces in the past as he has today. So I'm very pleased to see him refer to our surfaces as being in the highest on record. And say, but look, even if things have gone well this year, the estimate is that it's going to be 20 million. The only point I would gently make in that respect is that when we reached a surplus of 82 million, our estimate even then was for a surplus of in the region of 25 million. So we had a surplus over our estimated surplus of approximately 60 million. That is not to say that we don't always plan for the lower surplus. Now, our estimated surplus is what our estimate is based on. If we then have a higher surplus, so be it. Let's just remember that even when we do record surpluses, we have an estimated record surpluses because the estimate is prudent, the surplus finally is reality such as it may have been. Indeed, but reality could be a deficit, but the surplus is reality against a lower estimate. So the COVID fund will now be published quarterly after the publication of this afternoon of the Gazette containing the fund. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman said that fund will reflect some of their ideas as well as our ideas and the changes that they propose to our presentation on this, and a testament to the cooperation in these exceptional times. So, Mr. Speaker, we have worked very well today. And you know, that the default setting in politics seems to be that you have to not work well together and that you somehow, through a show of gladiatorial ability to slay the other, manage to persuade people that they should elect you to be your country's chief representative and, in the context of it, also diplomat, ironically. I am certainly going to try and ensure that we continue to work together insofar as we are able, and that we should see this only as the beginning of the ability to see both sides of the House cooperate. And indeed, if I may say so, with respect to others in the party, the historic inability of the GSC and the GSOP to work together has been slowed by the virus. And I think that is hugely important, and it's something to take as a positive from these days. Mr. Speaker, when the Honourable Gentleman did the analysis, which I had done also, was to say the areas which have gone beyond the W, now the DOJ, the education and ERS, I was struck myself, actually, when he said it, not when I had written it, but when he said it, that this demonstrates what really matters to the citizens. Our health, and the health of our people, the education of our young people, and the care of our elders. And there could be no better manifestation of that than in the way that we spend our money. And so everything has to continue running, so the administration is doubled, but more for the care of our people in health, for the education of our children and young people, and looking after
our credibility. Mr. Speaker, I have been very concerned about the fact that grant funding has not yet reached all students. And here's raised the point today, the Honourable Minister for Education and I have been dealing with these issues. There are, as you rightly said, no issues here of not being, not having the money available. These are unfortunately mechanical issues. Mechanical issues aggravated, unfortunately, by the pandemic because we've had later testing of the people at the university. We've then had the difficulties that have arisen as a result of what could only technically be described as that bleeding algorithm that affected A-level results in GCSE, which meant everything was delayed. People had offers and then counter offers and then decided to go for the first offer after they decided no offer. It's been chaos. And I entirely sympathize with the people in our Department for Education because they had a lot less time to deal with a lot more people. Because look, the numbers of people in higher education have gone up every single year since 1980. So more people go away every year for undergraduate degrees, and then some more additionally, especially since our election in 2011, for secondary degrees, which are also an issue. So the numbers have just increased, and we have fallen down in being able mechanically this year to deal with the payment of students give us their bank details, that also takes time, we then have to input things, and it's wrong that we should have not been able to deal with that in the short of time available, although I understand why it hasn't happened, and it must not happen again. But it is a mechanical failure, and all students can have the security and safety of the mechanical failure, and that they will soon be receiving their grant money that they haven't received yet. They're ready to do the full. The money is there. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman asked what's the difference between the 9 million and the 40 million that we have seen. There was 9 million the cost of the June, but 40 million is the extra over that we're putting into the GSA. So I venture where NJ's here to say, and say, look, the in health, every year we exceed the budget. So when we throw into the normal run of health, which is every year through the budget and we add COVID, that's where you're getting more or less to those numbers. So there will be a better breakdown at the end of the 24-month year that we will now be dealing with. And that, Mr. Speaker, is the situation. We are dealing with a 24-month year. And that is what we're voting to create in this House. If we could vote to make the earth flat and it would be meaningful, we might be persuaded to do so. It is meaningful that we're going to vote for a 24-month year because it means that we can continue the expenditure that we provided for the department for 12 months over the 24 months, or there will be one global financial year. So it's only the definition of year that we change. And Mr. Speaker, we see examples of this in other parliaments where estimates are paroled. The current parliament is caught in a vice of being able to agree in majority based on not being able to vote for a new budget. So they're constantly proroguing their association equivalent of 2017, I think, or 16-17. They're still stuck in that financial year extending and proroguing, not related to COVID. But here we're doing it because of COVID. Mr. Speaker, I welcome his support for the work that Fellas is doing. I've announced that Fellas is going to be meeting again next week and then regularly every 2 weeks after that. And I entirely agree with his views that there is a financial limit to what this community can do. We're a small community, we're a small economy. The father of the house can develop that scheme further. We have to cut our feet to fit the profit that we have. And that is a financial reality we must always deal with more now than ever. And so, Mr. Speaker, in commending this bill to the House, I'm thanking all honourable members for their contributions. What I would say is that the next budget, Mr. Speaker, is when we're going to have to really stretch every signal and work together to ensure that that reality check is one that we together present to our community as the one that they need to understand. It's just a new reality in this world. I commend the vote.
I now put the question, which is that the bill for an act to amend the Appropriation Act 2019 be read a second time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
The Appropriation Act 2019, Amendment Number 2, Act 2020.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to give notice of the committee statement for reading of the voting statement today, Rolling Amendment 3.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stays on third reading of the bill be taken today?
Committee stays on third reading, the honourable contention.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to resolve on behalf of the move, sorry, the House of Revolvers, second to committee, to consider the following bill for five floors. The Appropriations Act 2019, Amendment Number 2, Bill 2020.
A bill for an act to amend the Appropriation Act 2019. Clauses 1 to 3.
Clauses 1 to 3 form part of the bill.
The wrong title.
The wrong title forms part of the bill.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to report that the Appropriations Act 2019, Amendment Number 2 for 2020, has been considered in committee and passed.
I now put the question, which is that the Appropriations Act 2019, Amendment Number 2, Bill 2020, be read a third time and passed. Those in favour of the Appropriation Act 2019, Amendment Number 2, Bill 2020. Those against, carried.
We now come to bills for the second reading. A bill for an act to amend the Animals Act in relation to service animals. The Honourable Minister for the Environment, Sustainability and Climate Change.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Animals Act in relation to service animals be read a third time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Animals Act in relation to service animals be read a third time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Animal Amendment Number 2 Act 2020.
Mr. Speaker, I rise now to move that the House should adjourn to Friday the 16th of October at 2:30 in the afternoon. Mr. Speaker, the reason I am sitting in the House for that date is that it is anticipated at this time that there should be a meeting of the European Council on the 15th of October. And that is the date that the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and the President of the European Commission have given as the date by which they expect, if possible, there should be an agreement between the United Kingdom and the European Union on the, what we might call the main Brexit deal. I anticipate that there will be a lot of activity between now and then, which will prevent the Deputy Chief Minister and Minister being in Parliament. And I anticipate to be working closely to group members of the Council of Ministers and the leaders of the Commission and the Standing Arms between now and then. And for that reason, speaking of not to have to let the House down again, I'm proposing that we should move to come back.
I now propose a question, which is that this House is now adjourned to Friday, the 16th of October at 3:30 p.m. I now put the question, which is that this House is now adjourned to Friday, the 16th of October at 3:30 p.m. Those in favor? Those against? Pass. The House is now adjourned to Friday, the 16th of October at 3:30 p.m.